All right. A little past 8 a.m., we're going to call the Property Tax Relief and Local Sales Tax Division together. Members, our intent is just to continue through these bills till the end. Sounds like we don't have to be out of this room at any one time. So our first bill up is House File 2850, and Vice Chair Brown has that bill, and I'll move to lay this over and the possible inclusion into an omnibus bill. So Representative Brown, if you would please proceed.
Mr. Chair, House File 2850 is a bill that's going to add brother and sister of the owner or owner's spouse to the list of relatives who already receive a homestead classification for ag land, and I'm going to let Mr. Peterson speak to the bill, please.
Mr. Peterson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 2850. I also would note that I'm spoke with Chris Raddatz from the Farm Bureau, and he asked me to also indicate to the committee their support for this legislation. The bill, of course, would extend agricultural homestead classification eligibility to brothers and sisters. We've supported changes to these provision in past years. I believe 2 years ago, Representative Westrum successfully amended the law to include grandsons or granddaughters also. We believe that this is a close kindred, brother and sister. There, you know, at times we've talked about adding cousins, and who knows, maybe someday that'll be the issue too. But a lot of brothers and sisters do farm together in different situations. And I think a good reason to do this is also with the combination of declining farmers, high land values. This seems like a logical expansion to help Minnesota farmers attain some kind of tax relief, but at the same time encourage continuation of farming enterprise within the family. And we also think there's protections in this bill. It says, you know, you need to be actively involved in the farming operation. You have to live nearby in order the class, and you also need to prove the classifications to the when you're applying for it. So you do need to apply for this. And we do believe those requirements protect against any kind of abuse. And also, you know, consider a couple of facts in deciding if this is needed now or as we're trying to help people who are actually living on farms and farming, that now more than half of the farmland in Minnesota is rented that's being run by farmers. And we have 79,000 farmers in our state. And I was just looking at some of the numbers. And of that 79,000, you could be somebody like me who sells three steers. It's anybody who has $1,000 of gross income qualifies at that $1,000 level. So we're down to about 20,000 that have gross sales of 100,000 or more, and about 50,000 that have gross sales of 10,000 or more. So that's, you know, kind of the numbers we're talking about. And we always want to encourage those people. And one other point is that, you know, only 6% of the nation's farmers are under 35 years of old age. So anything we can do to help encourage that, I appreciate your consideration for including this in your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Also on special agricultural homestead, right now it's 4 township distance. Would you be in favor of looking at replacing that with adjoining county versus 4 townships?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we would. Yep, and we've looked at that, and I was just curious, like, when Representative Brown, I know that she's brought this bill, too, spoken with a farmer in her district because of a constituent, and, you know, I was curious how this works you have to be a resident of the state, too, so a lot of the people down in the border there, too, but absolutely.
Representative Brown, do you have any other testifiers on this bill? Is there anyone in the audience that would care to speak for or against House File 2850? Any members' questions? Representative Brown, any closing comments on 2850?
Well, you know, my district is heavily ag, and so I'm hoping for your support of this bill and giving an opportunity to continue and extend on the family farm.
Thank you very much. We don't have a quorum yet, so we actually can't lay this over. So we'll come back to that, this one, and we will go to the next one we have. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have House File 3892, Representative Brown.
Good
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3435 is a bill that was brought to me by a constituent. It is a bill that would help a help continue the ability for the organization to receive tax exemption for land. This is something that they have received for the past 20 years, and because of some circumstances, they don't qualify right now, and this bill would help them continue to qualify for the exemption status. And then I have Mr. Larry Tompkins, who would be willing to speak about this more deeply.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tompkins, please state your name and then please proceed.
I'm Larry Tompkins. I'm a retired superintendent of schools, and I have an interest in this bill as a community member and one whose family has been able to take advantage of our area and local sportsman's club. The Southland Sportsman's Club is what an issue has come up that has prompted this proposed bill. You need to know that the club's purpose and the way it has operated has not changed one iota in the last 20-some years that it's been tax-exempt. The change has been in an interpretation.
Mr. Tompkins, would you explain a little bit of what this is? What type of a recreational club?
Yes. It's a club that it's totally for the public good. We purchase, as we can, small parcels of land to preserve them for public use. Whether it be hiking, picnicking, hunting. The land is clearly marked as being public. There's a signage on each corner of a parcel of property that states that it is for public use, and it also has a little statement asking anybody that uses the property to respect the neighboring property, which would be private. The parcels, they run, typically they're 10, 12 acres, wooded land. It's non-productive land. We do have one parcel that is 40 acres that's along a stream on both sides, but the typical is 10 to 12 acres. This would have no tax impact on the local area or the state because it has been tax exempt for a long time. And I think that there are other organizations that have the same purpose that would benefit from this bill also. Pheasants Forever comes to mind. They do the same thing, trying to preserve public land for public use. I think, you know, one of the things that comes to my mind is in some ways I see us lessening the burden on government, because our DNR purchases land frequently for public use, to preserve it for public use, and we're doing exactly the same thing, and it's not requiring an outlay of public dollars to do that. But actually, if the truth were known, we go beyond the qualifications of this bill. We meet all of these and go beyond. I don't know if you're familiar with the North Star case. It's a landmark Supreme Court case in Minnesota that established the criteria for a purely public charity. And in my judgment, I can show where we actually meet all of those criteria. We do things with our local school system. The school uses our properties for to enhance their environmental and natural resources curriculum, their classes. We also work with the schools in conducting training and snowmobile training, gun training. They're all conducted on school site. Absolutely no revenue comes to our club whatsoever. Our funds come strictly from, we have a steak fry gun raffle fundraiser. We have two small parcels that at one time had been 10 acres, 10, 12 acres of farmland, and We purchased it and planted it to trees. And because it was farmland, we do get some CPR money from that. But we're talking about $1,100 total. So that's our total sources of income.
Mr. Tompkins, why? You said you had been receiving property tax exemption for many years. What changed?
That's a good question. I don't know that I can... I'll share with you what the local assessor
assessors always talk about.
Yeah. He made reference to the North Star case, and he made reference to getting some information from the Department of Revenue and a memo that indicated that just because you do snowmobile training or gun training for kids doesn't mean that you're going to be tax exempt or should be tax exempt. We go way beyond that. So his reference was to that North Star case. And like I say, I think I can show that we even meet those standards if the truth were known.
Well, Mr. Tompkins, if I'm understanding you right, you think, was the assessor, did he come out this year? Was it after this Under the Rainbow case that the nonprofits are concerned about? It sounds like he's for some reason, they've looked at something and they think you're not purely public charity anymore.
Right. It's one of those, and it could be, because he's new to our area, so coming in from another area, it could be. There's something that his information that he has gotten that would indicate to him that the interpretation is that, and he also alluded to the fact that, you know, our land is non-productive. There is no developed access to it other than getting in with, you know, with hiking or perhaps four-wheelers or whatever. You can get close to it, but he said that they're valuable. That land is valuable as home sites, and maybe if somebody wanted to spend quite a bit of money, and there's maybe people out there that would do that, but I guess I don't know that it ought to be taxed some value that he's talking about, when it's not used for that value. The other thing I would mention is that it's in our charter that this, if something were to happen to our club, the land would be donated to another public entity, DNR, the schools, or townships, someone that would preserve it in the same way as public use as we are and meet the same criteria.
Members, Representative Anderson and Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brown I forgot your name again.
Larry Tompkins.
Mr. Tompkins, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. I think it's very admirable, and I understand the pressure you're on. I guess, Representative Brown, I think I would be more comfortable if this language at this time was more of anybody that was receiving the property tax exemption would maintain that until we can delve more into this issue. Because my only concern is that there are very clever people out there that would take advantage of something like this and would form a nonprofit and then have, you know, a nonprofit status, you know, tax-free until the timing was right to develop property, and then they'd, you know, make millions and then having years worth of a property tax exemption. And we all know there's people out there that are very good about that. And unfortunately, it impacts you, but I guess I would just be more comfortable if the language in this bill kind of was tightened up so that we didn't, you know, create a problem that of unintended consequences with you trying to help these folks. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Representative Brown.
Representative Anderson, I appreciate those comments, and I do share that concern now that you've brought it up as well. I would be willing to work with language that would acknowledge your concern. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Demmer, I guess, is on the list. And Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Larry. How are you?
How are you?
Good. Nice to see you again. Two questions. Number one, are there other developments around there? Are there housing? Is there housing developing around the area? Is there a rationale for the assessor to say to expand into
no.
where this is?
No. Representative Dimmer, they are totally, I mean, they're miles from town. And like I say, they're out. I should qualify. There was a piece of land not very far out of Adams that was flooded along a stream, and there was some housing there. It was not incorporated in the town, but and Puma came in and bought up the property, and FEMA donated that property to our sportsman's club, and it's along a bike trail, and we're going to work with that.
So. Representative Demme.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I got to say, Larry, I was going to say Larry.
Yeah,
I'm familiar with the area, and I understand that. It's farm country,
sure.
Is what it is, and I understand. Second thing is, how much is the property tax that you got levied this year?
It's not been levied.
Okay, you don't know yet.
So I don't.
Any guess?
Does
it give you an idea?
Well, if you know, just in my conversations with the assessor, mm-hmm. he's talking about it being what land would be worth as out in a rural site for housing, for a home site. You know, you could be looking at $100,000, and so it'd be a pretty significant tax. If the resources that we have at this point in time, we'd have to do something different to increase those considerably if we were going to have to pay the taxes.
Okay, thank you.
And I can share any financial information with the group if they wish to.
Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. From our earlier conversations with Revenue about this issue, I got the impression that they were open to kind of a moratorium on these individual situations that may be cropping up around the state. So I would encourage a conversation with Revenue here to see if, in fact, they could talk to the assessor and maybe hold off, because we are going to have a study that's going to take place with regard to this issue and its effect on nonprofits. The other thing I want to ask you about is, have you ever thought about turning these properties over to the county? And having the county, since you operate them as basically as a public park, it seems to me that most of the counties have some kind of park activity where they're owning park property, and some are more involved than others. But have you ever thought about doing that,
Mr. Thompson?
Yeah, Representative Lanning. We haven't thought about so much the county, but the assessor did a mention that you could consider townships doing. Now, townships, they would probably be willing to, I shouldn't assume that, but I would think they would balk at being involved in having the property at least in name. I don't think they would want to manage it or anything like that. But we haven't. I'm kind of thinking the county, because they're all, I mean, like I say, they're such small pieces, and they're just all over the area. It's not like a park that you could go in and do something with. I really haven't delved into it a lot.
Representative Lanning.
Well, I would suggest that maybe you consider that too as an alternative, because you could turn over ownership to the county or townships involved and still have an agreement with them that your organization was going to maintain those parcels, and that would totally avoid this whole issue.
Any other comments from members? Is there anyone here in the audience for or against? We have one testifier here. If you'd please come forward and Mr. Tompkins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please state your name.
Thank you, Chair Mark Ward and members. My name is Gloria Pinky, and I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, but I'm here today as a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. And to this very issue, I was under the impression that the Department of Revenue has notified all county assessors to put a moratorium, just like Representative Lanning had indicated. And to my knowledge, Obviously not all, but certainly most assessors have done just that. Rather than going out and reacting to the Rainbow case, we're holding off until we find out what the study that the legislature does come up with. So I just wanted to get that on the record. Oh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I wonder if there's anyone here. I don't see Mr. Hagan from the Department of Revenue. If we could get out. Which county are we talking about?
Moore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if we could maybe have the Department of Revenue contact that county just to make sure they receive the memo that went out. Oh, there we go. I'm sorry. Yes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance DiRico from the Department of Revenue. We will do that. Okay. I'm sorry. A little bit more to that point. The letter that we sent out with regard to Under the Rainbow thus far merely told the assessors that we didn't think the court case changed much and that we would be contacting them further. So we have not formally sent a letter out asking them to impose a moratorium or anything like that.
Okay.
We've worked with the chair, I forget the name of the House file, on the moratorium for the public, purely public charities. That has not been enacted yet. So we have not formally told the assessors to, in effect, do a moratorium this year yet. So we didn't expect this kind of thing to happen, as the previous testifier indicated. And we will talk to the county assessor. And I don't know anything particular about this situation, so I can't speak to this situation.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and of course that the nonprofit moratorium isn't law yet, and I appreciate the department already working on that. But I think the intent, anyway, of the division here and all concerned is that basically if there isn't a change in use or whatever of the property, that things would kind of stay the same until we've at least kind of worked this out. And I would think what I'm hearing from Mr. Tompkins is it doesn't sound like there's been any use change or anything like that. So if we could look into that situation, I'd really appreciate that. So,
Mr. Chair, I think based on what I've heard this morning and based on what I know of the situation, I guess it would be pretty safe for me to apologize to Mr. Tompkins on behalf of the department. We didn't expect a change in the kind of situation that you just described.
So, thank you very much. Appreciate the department working on that. Anything else? Anyone else for or against House File 3892? Anything else, Representative, you'd care to bring?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate having the opportunity to have this conversation and also comments that were just made about contacting my county about the moratorium and reminding them what's going on there.
Okay. With that, I'll move to layover House File 3892. Thank you very much. And also at this time, I'll move the layover House File 2850, which was Representative Brown's other bill. We also have a quorum, so let's take the minutes before we forget. We have minutes from Wednesday, March 26, 2008. Anyone care to move those minutes? Representative Anderson moves the March 26, 2008 minutes. Any discussion on those? If not, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. Is Mr. Corbett from Washington County here? Okay, so then we'll do this bill. We'll stay in order since you're here, and then we'll go back. So, Representative Brown, if you would take over the reins here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Court, would you like to introduce your bill?
Thank you very much, and I'd like to move House File 3645 for possible inclusion. Members, House File 3645 is really trying to clarify law. Right now, if an entity does not set its proposed levy, like by about September 15th, it's unclear what the county auditor is supposed to send out on the P&T statements that go out. If, in fact, it gets to the final levy in December, then under state law, what the county would do if
If an entity hasn't set their levy, they would set last year's levy. That is on the final levy, but for the proposal that goes out in the TNT, it's unclear. And so I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Corbett, who's got a situation he can describe and why we need to. What this bill then would do is, under the proposed, also set the levy that they had last year, the proposed that would go out to property owners. So I'll let you
explain. Mr. Corbett, would you state your name for the tape, please?
Chair, I'm Kevin Corbett, the Director of Property Records and Taxpayer Services for Washington County. The situation we had last fall was a city contacted the county auditor's office, and they had a 2-2 vote on adopting its city proposed levy. And the question to the county auditor's office is, if we do not certify to you, what are you going to do? First thing we always do is look at the statutes to get direction and talk to the Department of Revenue. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that there was no direction in state law on what happens if a proposed levy is not certified to us. We were put in a situation to make a decision at the county auditor's level, which we did, which we told the city was that we would take proposed, or their last year's final levy as their proposed levy, even though there was no direction in state law. So we think it's just preferable to have the state law be clear on what happens if a proposed levy is not certified to the county auditor in a timely fashion. I'd answer any questions you may have.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Markwood, this is great. It is definitely needed to be cleared up. I'm just curious, though, would this create a situation where people would decide not to certify it? Is there some kind of language we can maybe put in there that would be an incentive to make sure that they do try and file on time and so forth?
Representative Markwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I was thinking of that, and I actually would think this would be somewhat of a protection to the taxpayer, in that it just sets, if you can't come to a conclusion, it set at last year's levy, which means they can't go over that. They could only go under it. So I think for a city that would want to, raise its levy, it would be disadvantaged to them not to set something. So I don't know if we need to do that, because I think the taxpayer is being protected, at least from not going over last year's levy amount, if my understanding would be correct on that. So I don't know if we need to do that. If you have some ideas, I would certainly be open, but I think it would be disadvantaged to the city not to set that proposed levy, especially if it's going up.
Are there any questions? Are there any testifiers from the audience? Representative Markwart, any final comments?
No, I think I appreciate the testimony here. I think it's something we need to clear up.
Okay. House File 3645 is then laid over for possible inclusion.
Members, I was just informed that went on to the Senate tax bill yesterday, so I'm glad I didn't mention that ahead of time. It might have impacted the discussion here, so it did go on to the Senate bill, if that says anything. Yeah, it's not really maybe ringing endorsement, but anyway, that's just the facts as I view them. All right. Let's see, we're going to move on. We have Representative Hosh, I've seen. I saw. Representative Hosh, are you ready to go? All right, we are. Then we will go to House File 3795. Representative Hosh, and you have an amendment, I see.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, and if you could give me a little leeway. I have a few oral amendments to amendments that are technical in nature.
Ooh. Representative Hosh, you're kind of pushing things.
Representative Mary Ann. Okay. Please. Okay. Well, first of all, we have a motion to lay over House File 3795 to get this moving. So, Representative Loeffler moves to lay over House File 3795. All right. Okay. What would you like to do first?
Mr. Chair, on line 2.4, I would like to strike point 6.5.
Okay, are we on the bill or the amendment?
On the amendment.
Okay, well, we've been moved. Let's do the amendment first. So, we've got an A1 amendment. Yes. All right. Representative Wassler, will you move the A1 amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Okay. And do we adopt the amendment and then add the oral? Okay. So we'll add the oral. All right. Very good. Now,
and I apologize for this, Mr. Chair.
Nope, that is fine.
So line 2.4, point 6.5 would be changed to point 5.5.
Which line was that, Representative?
3.4, Mr. Chair.
3.4.
2.4.
2.4. All right. From 0.65 to
0.55.
And that's what was passed in our earlier bill.
Yes, and that was what was included in the original bill that I had. That's
very good.
And then 2.8 to strike the word annually.
Okay. All right, let's go. Representative Hosh, it's at 0.65, and you want to lower it now to 0.55?
You want to lower it to 0.55 to line up with what agriculture property.
Okay, okay, very good. And then your next one,
I'm sorry. On line 2.8, strike annually.
Do you have that? Okay. So the oral amendment is line 2.4, strike 0.65, replace with 0.55, and on line 2.8, strike the word annually.
Correct.
All right. Speak to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your time on this Friday morning. Hopefully we can get out and go home in a relatively decent time. But House File 3795 continues to focus its efforts on preventing the fragmentation of forest land in Minnesota. With this bill, we are trying to enhance certain aspects of the Class 2B property tax treatment of forested land. Normally, you're probably asking yourself why I'm here today and I'm not Representative Bill or Solberg or Representative Rukavina, and I just wanted to give the committee a break. But in all reality, why I'm carrying this land today is not only do we have forest lands in far northern Minnesota, but we also see the pressure of development in central Minnesota and other faster growing areas of the state trying to take away our forested lands throughout Minnesota. And my district is a prime example of that with the Avon Hills area. So that is why I'm here for you today. And I'm grateful for Representative Solberg and Rukavina's leadership, and I hope that they can forgive me for, you know, not being as effective as they may be. But in this case, I wanted to make sure that I focused on some of the efforts and some of the problems that we're seeing in my area and make sure that we have a progressive approach with state tax policy. This bill builds on provisions that have already been enacted in the tax bill that we passed earlier this session. After the 2007 session, a broad-based coalition of organizations concerned with the preservation of our forest lands continued to work on this very issue with the 2B tax class. It was included in the omnibus tax bill, and we all know the fate of the omnibus tax bill last year, and it wasn't because of this provision in any way. In your packet, you have a copy of a letter that was sent from many organizations supporting this legislation before the 2008 session started. As you can see, there's a broad coalition from the Audubon Society to the Deer Hunters Association to the Rough Grouse Society and from recreation property owners. One organization since then has been added to the list of endorsing this legislation, that's the Nature Conservancy. House File 3795 provides further adjustment to the tax rate for forested land that meets the 2B requirements. It also includes some provisions that will make this provision easier for county assessors to administer as application for this classification is done. I have with me Bruce Zumbauen from the Minnesota Forestry Association, who can speak on behalf of this bill and probably be able to answer questions to a much greater ability than I can. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Zumbauen.
Mr. Zumbauen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I'm Bruce Umballen, chair of the Government Relations Committee for the Minnesota Forestry Association, otherwise known as MFA. And MFA is Minnesota's oldest conservation organization, founded in 1876. Our mission is to promote wise stewardship of the state's forest lands through advocacy and our educational programs, particularly focused on those woodlands owned by families. At a family forest stewardship conference at St. John's University last September, particular concerns were expressed over property taxes acting as a deterrent to encouraging owners to retain and manage those woodlands. The conference planners asked MFA to take the lead in seeking support from other like-minded conservation organizations to address those concerns. The result was a letter that the committee members should have received in January of this year with the signatures of the 10 organizations that Representative Posh just mentioned. And he, as he mentioned, the Nature Conservancy has since endorsed those provisions. We would like to thank the legislature for addressing some of the issues with the passage and enactment of the Omnibus Tax Bill, House File 3201, earlier this session. And this bill, 3795, built upon those provisions. And enacting these provisions will greatly help in encouraging woodland owners to manage their woodlands and not compel them to subdivide and sell their land for development due to high property taxes. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, and I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions on this? Is there anyone from the audience who would like to speak for or against? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mark Gordon. Good morning, members. My name again is Gloria Pinky. I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, and I'm here today as a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. First off, I'd like to thank the committee and Representative Hosh for bringing this bill forward. It does address the issues that were defined and discussed very closely by the Department of Revenue and with my colleagues in the assessment profession, and we appreciate this bill. It will help. We also appreciate the addition of the language regarding the Commission of Natural Resources, and I agree that it will help assessors not only make the task easier, it will also ensure more consistency throughout the state, and I know that's been an issue as we go forward. So that's all I wanted to say and get on record, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have any idea what size, how much land we're talking about here? Is we, are we talking about thousands of acres? Or?
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Earhart. According to the information provided to me, there's 192,000 family forest landowners in Minnesota that own closely to 5.3 million acres of forest. This is about 33% of Minnesota's forest land base.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
that's significant. Representative Earhart.
Yeah, that's more than I thought. I thought we were talking about a 10-acre parcel here or there, but it doesn't sound like that. Now, how much money are we shifting to homestead in another land?
Does anyone know how much money we're shifting on other property owners?
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry.
There is a fiscal, a revenue estimate on this bill, and it focuses on the net tax change to be a decrease of $5.8 million.
Excuse me, 3 to 5?
No, it focuses on the net tax change to decrease by $5.8 million. So that's the rough estimate on what the impact would be.
Mr. Chairman, then we are shifting that amount of money to...
Right, and if you read further in the revenue estimate, it would shift to other properties, and they're anticipating that it would, Department of Revenue, this is the revenue note, anticipates an increase of $200,000 per year in increased property tax refunds.
Very good question, Representative Earhart. So it would be certainly a shift to other property owners.
And a sizable one, Mr. Chairman, from the sounds of it. Mr. Chairman, we can make a lot of properties lower their rates and so forth, and exempt them, and we end up then the homestead folks are going to be paying more, which is one of the things we're trying to keep under control.
Thank you. Any other? All right, please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And we are at the conference in St. John's and support this bill and the amendments. A lot of the seasonal rec owners in the state are forest land owners with hunting lands and other forest lands that become classified as seasonal rec. And it's I hear a lot of complaints from our members that it's very difficult to steward their land, and their taxes are very high, and there's a lot of pressure for them to subdivide and sell it. I think this bill is a good step in the right direction towards providing incentive for sound stewardship of Minnesota's forests and lakes, the majority of which are owned by families, more than the national forest, more than the state.
Thank you. Representative Hosh.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to make sure that the committee understands that we are simply mirroring the same practices that we use for undeveloped agricultural land. And we're trying to be consistent with that policy. This is nothing new. This is not, a new favor that we just thought up. This is being consistent with current practice that we see throughout the entire state of Minnesota. We want to preserve agricultural land for our food supply and for our family farms. We ought to do the same thing when it comes to preserving our forest land. In my district, I have several areas that are FNA lands that are very, I think, very valuable and unique to Minnesota, and we want to make sure that the individuals who own those properties have the ability to maintain and preserve their land with a long-range forest development or management plan, and this will allow them to do that.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hosser, Representative Hosser, or others who might be able to answer. I certainly support us encouraging responsible management and preservation of our forest lands, but I see that, based on the information I just got, if there's almost 200,000 parcels, and the Commissioner of Natural Resources has to annually concur that the land qualifies and it's being managed, has the Department of Natural Resources said they can handle this within their workload, or has that been accommodated in some other way?
Representative Hodge, or Mr. Zumballin, or whoever can answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, input was sought from the department. Right now, landowners have the opportunity to register their stewardship plans with the DNR. The DNR has said that they can provide a list of those that register their plans, and this would greatly help the assessors so that they wouldn't have to have the folks come in and apply annually. So they could provide that. And this is something that the assessors really, really wanted very much.
Any other questions? Anyone else? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoshi had a quick question. I'm looking at the 1.22 through 1.27, where it talks about foot classing, foot parcels. You might understand that if I have a home that is on a 20-acre or more parcel, that I could then get my home and the parcel to be classified as rural vacant land. Did I understand that correctly?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, this provision, when it talks about non-residential and ancillary structures, is mainly to address like tree stands, I believe, and not a homestead.
Oh, non-residential. Okay.
Anyone else from
That's
the
audience? Deer hunter support.
Anyone else from the audience that would care to speak for or against? If not, we do have the we need to vote on the amendment, the A1 amendment. And then we'll go back to the bill, so we should have probably done this sooner. But all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion, the amendment is adopted. Anything else, Representative Hosh, you would care to add?
I would just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for taking the time today, and would appreciate your support.
Representative Loeffler, then, will renew her motion to lay over House File 3795. Thank you so much.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. We're gonna move to House File 4097 because I think this is a very quick one. Plus, we have a testifier who is here for an earlier bill, and we'll be able to let him be on his way so we can keep county government working efficiently in the state of Minnesota. So, do I hear someone to move the layover House File 4097?
So
Representative Loeffler moves to layover House File 4097. Representative Dabney, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for moving us up on the agenda and allowing the counties to continue to work today. House File 4097, members, currently taxpayers who are delinquent on their property taxes but otherwise qualify for the property tax refund program are disqualified from that program. House File 4097 would change that, allowing taxpayers who are delinquent on their taxpayers to still qualify for the program. The taxpayer would not receive the PTR reimbursement, but instead that money would flow to the county and be credited against their delinquent taxes. And of course, that revenue then would be allowed to pass through to other taxing jurisdictions, just as it normally would if the taxpayer were in good standing on their taxes. With me today is, backed by popular demand, Mr. Kevin Corbett from Washington County as Director of their Property Records and Taxpayer Services.
Thank you very much, Mr. Corbett.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you again. This idea arose from the Legislative Committee of the County Auditor and Treasurer's Association. After opportunities to speak with members over the last 2 years, beginning really with the chairman's efforts to engage the public in ways to change the property tax system to make it more efficient and simple for them, we were tasked with looking at how can we make it easier for taxpayers to make their payments and stay current in their taxes. Ideas that came up from the legislature were the ideas of the monthly payments and those kinds of ideas that were flowing last year. The county auditors, in their efforts, were talking about the number of phone calls they get from taxpayers who are delinquent or behind on their current taxes, who tell us that they're otherwise eligible but can't access the refund program because of the delinquency, and how that at certain times they could find the money to pay off their delinquencies or their overdue current if they had the refund already credited to their account. So the examples we would get from taxpayers is that I owe $1,000, I can't put $1,000 right now to get current, but I might have $600 if the $400 I'm going to get in a refund can be credited to my account, and then I'll find the $600 and now I'm current. Those are the kinds of calls that we get at the county level. It was brought forward, and we thought it was a reasonable idea to at least have considered by the legislature, and that's why the bill was proposed in this fashion. With that, I will answer any questions that the committee may have.
Anyone? You know, last year when I looked at this, I wasn't a big supporter of that because I thought, how can you give a property tax refund to someone who hasn't paid property taxes? There's no property taxes paid yet. But is this a little different now, the electronic filing versus last year? Because I like that part of it. And as you mentioned, it will, you know, reduce the amount that the person would initially have to pay. I guess my only question is, would this create an incentive for other property taxpayers who could, let's say, normally pay, but says, you know, I know I'm going to get a property tax refund, so I'm just going to wait for it to go delinquent, and then I will pay through this method. And I'm just wondering, on the county side, if a lot of people did that, you would lose a little cash flow coming in, little interest payments, and might actually cost you some money besides having the kind of extra paperwork and time to do more delinquent things. I mean, is there an incentive in here for people to say, geez, this is kind of a good way to go?
Mr. Chair and members,
Mr. Corbett,
I think it's a good question. I think any incentive that's created by this is more than offset by the disincentive that comes with the penalties and interest that are charged on taxes. If you recall, on homesteaded property, the day after you're late, it's a 2% penalty on May 16th and October 16th. And so I think folks that can pay, that there's a major disincentive to not pay because of the penalty and interest rates that begin to accrue and are fairly significant when you look at them. So I think that
Mr. Corbett, you work with it every day. And So would you say that a bill like this would actually, in the long term, help your property tax revenues and get some of those delinquent payers that may not pay? In your opinion, working with this every day?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that it would. I can't really quantify the amount. I was a little surprised by the revenue notes on how much this might cost. But frankly, I guess, you know, if there's that many delinquent taxpayers who qualify for the program, that this could mean more taxpayers take advantage of this than I originally thought might be. I think this is a fairly unique set of taxpayers that may find this to be an advantageous thing for them. Yeah, Representative Dabney asked me on the way in this morning about the delinquency rates in counties, and I can just speak from perspective of Washington County. Normally, we have about a 1 to 1.25% delinquency rate at the end of any current taxable year. At the end of 2007, we have a 1.9% delinquency. So there's been a fairly significant uptick in the delinquency rates, at least in my county, for 2007. So I think it is clear that folks are having a harder time now staying current on their property tax payments than in previous years, and that more folks may utilize this to either stay current or get current when there are delinquent taxes.
Thank you. Any members? Any other questions? Anyone from the audience or against House File 4097? Anybody? Representative Walker.
Mr. Chairman, and this is just continuing to learn it. When you have a foreclosure, so the property actually gets, I mean, I assume that some of that increased non-collection is because people are in that foreclosure process, and there's a sheriff's sale, would any of those proceeds be going back to pay those delinquent taxes? And, you know, should the state potentially look at a recapture mechanism through that process as well, or?
Mr. Corbett?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the foreclosure process, when a sheriff's sale occurs, there is no requirement to pay either the current or delinquent taxes on the property. The taxes remain on the property at that time. Most of the time on these foreclosures, we're seeing the banks step in and making payments on the property tax. We've looked to see if there's any correlation between the folks that are going into delinquency and the foreclosures, and there's not to a great deal. We're not seeing that kind of effort. And the most part, what's happening is the banks that are foreclosing are keeping the taxes current because, like a property tax payer, they don't want the interest, penalties, those things to be accruing as well.
Any other questions? Representative Dabney, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I think we've covered it well. I'm going to go a little bit out of a limb, but I believe the PTR program is paid for out of the general fund. So while the chair raised the issue of people not paying property taxes being eligible for PTR under this, in fact, you know, I've never found a way to not pay income taxes, at least not without spending federal time as a result. So these folks are paying into the general fund through their income and sales taxes, and this would allow them to access the PTR program that they otherwise qualify for and may in fact set up an incentive for them to pay the additional portion of their property taxes that they otherwise are not able to make at this time. So I do think there's an eligibility issue that's positive here as well as an opportunity to help people get right on their property taxes and then hopefully stay right.
Well,
and I appreciate the time and consideration today.
Thank you for bringing this forward. Representative Daphne and Representative Wofford will renew her motion to lay over House File 4097. Thank you very much. We have a number of bills left, and I know a number of bills that have a number of testifiers, but I do want to check, because I do appreciate when people travel a long distance to make it down here. I know there's a number of people who did that. Is there anyone here that has traveled a distance that absolutely has a time certain that they have to be out of here? Is there any of the bills that Representative Rucavina, we're talking testifiers, not representatives. So if that's the case, we'll just kind of now continue, because I know there's a couple issues here that are going to warrant a little bit of testimony. So we're going to move to, I think Representative Mariani is here. We're going to move to House File 3509, And do I hear anyone that cares to put this one in the motion? Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Moves to lay over House File 3509. Representative Mariani.
Good morning.
I think this is your first time before this division.
And my maiden voyage.
Yes. Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'll be real brief, and then I've had a number of testifiers, and then there are individuals also who are here from the Papal Airport who also want to testify. Let me be brief. This bill would return the St. Paul Airport, which is currently located in my district, back to a status in regards to property taxes, the form of paying property taxes prior to 1996. In 96, we unattached the airport from both the city and the school district, and there's a tilt arrangement in regards to city services for the airport. And what happened was that in the 90s, the Metropolitan Airports Commission approached us and asked for this in order to be in conformance with the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. That's the same arrangement they have and have had for a long time. And the argument then was that they needed to create a more competitive economic reality with the St. Paul Intermediate, with MSP, because they wanted to be able to move smaller aircraft out of MSP into the other airports, and that the issue of the difference of expenses was a barrier to that. So this bill, a decade later, attempts to go back and say, no, let's go ahead and reattach. And the bill is offered for you to consider in light of several things. But what I would encourage the committee members is to think about sort of, you know, cost benefit, thinking here. One is, you know, is there economic benefit of the current cost structure versus the reattach property tax classification? And I think in order to do that, you have to think about a couple of things. One is whether or not there's been enhanced value that's happened at the St. Paul Intermediate Airport, and therefore enhanced economic activity. Two, whether or not the promise that the tenants made in terms of having a relationship with the St. Paul School District to provide career opportunity explorations, whether that's happened. And whether, in fact, you know, as the MAC has promised, additional small aircraft have been attracted to the St. Paul Airport in relief of the Minneapolis-St. Paul sort of overcrowded situation. And then, of course, you know, whether, in fact, there's been additional revenues that have been generated for the locals. And that gets a little bit trickier because of the way that the K-12 formula in particular works. And then the final thing, members, is that there's also, of course, the issue of principle here of whether or not we should be treating all property owners at the same rate or not. And let me just say that, as far as I know, the tenants down at St. Paul, Pullman, I haven't been very close to them in the past few years focusing on other issues, but I think they're pretty good tenants. However, there are certainly equity issues a number of my constituents have raised in regards to the difference in treating personal property in the district, and that's become increasingly acute given the fact that St. Paul, the city of St. Paul, has lost real loss of ground in LGA assistance from the state. And so we're looking at double-digit property tax increases for homeowners in St. Paul for this year and possibly for the next year, at the same time that we're having to lower services in the city. And that is, again, partly due to our failure as state government to be able to keep the promise of LGA assistance that we've historically had with St. Paul and a number of other jurisdictions as well. And as you know, Mr. Chair, last year's veto by the governor of the tax bill certainly did not help that situation. It resulted in millions and millions of lost assistance from the state to the city of St. Paul. So these are really acute issues for us, And it seems to me that we should be covering the entire ground in terms of looking at equity issues and our ability to bring in property tax revenue for the city. So with that, I'll leave it to you and to the testifiers, too.
Thank you very much. I'm just wondering if anyone has maybe a testifier role, but how much tax base are we talking about? Do we have that? Okay, so we'll just wait for the testifiers to do that. So very good. So Representative Mariani, if you would go ahead and have testifiers on your behalf come forward. And just please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Tom Diamond. And what this is it's an issue of fairness and needed revenue. As you know, St. Paul, as in most communities, we're really struggling, whether it be for revenues for the schools or for the parks, other facilities. People are literally out there doing bake sales and creative fundraising and stuff to help and assist in those programs so they can be funded. And the difficulty with the budget just gets harder. What we're talking about here is, and you can get into specific numbers, but is that the commercial properties, this is private, personal, commercial property, and they are paying no taxes to the city of St. Paul, and they are paying no taxes to the property taxes to the school district, and they are paying no property taxes to the fiscal disparity pool, and they are not paying to the state. This is over $600,000 annually that is not being paid to the various parties. And as far as fairness issue, I think it's important to put it into context. A couple of examples. There's an article not long ago that was run in the newspaper about one of the corporations in the metro area here that their CEO was receiving $98,000 a year of free travel on the corporate aircraft, personal travel, for himself and his family, and that they cracked down on him, and now they only allow $50,000 of free personal travel on the corporate aircraft on top of the $11.8 million annual salary and compensation that he receives. One of the corporations that flies out of the airport also recently gave one of their vice presidents not long ago a $100,000 cash bonus.
Mr. Diamond, would you kind of stick to the property tax?
I appreciate it. What the point is, in comparison, we have local businesses, for example, like Garabek Bakery, which is a short distance from us, which is a mom-and-pop bakery. We have the Sweet Hollow Cafe, which is another mom-and-pop operation. They pay property taxes, both city and the school district and the fiscal disparities. Retirees on fixed incomes pay taxes out of their fixed income. And some of the wealthiest, most well-off organizations are paying no taxes. Another one of the examples is benefits. The biggest benefit as far as not paying taxes is to a corporation, is an operation that is owned by a corporation which is owned by BDA Aviation in London, England. It's a multi a conglomerate headquartered out of London. So the biggest tax benefit is shipped to London, England, while homeowners and business owners locally have to pay our property taxes. I think it's also important to point out that as far as this issue of MST versus Holman Field, the reason why MST, the International Airport, does not pay to the school district and to the city is because it's federal property. It's the old fort, and so it was not within one of those boundaries. Whether you want to address that as a separate issue, that's fine. But I think it's important not to compare it with that property, but to compare it with other airports. For example, Anoka Airport or Flying Claw, the operators out of their pay taxes at those facilities. And it's important also when they say, well, geez, NAC needed this break for these properties for them to be competitive so they wouldn't go and locate at the MAC. That's totally without any basis. MAC controls who they lease to. If they don't want a property, an operator out of that airport, they don't lease to them. If they don't want to be discompetitive. They don't want to be having lower rates than Holland. They control the leases at both airports. They could set the leases at both airports as to what they feel are appropriate to encourage one kind of operation at one field and one kind of operation at another. It's not that the school district and the city and the park should not be the ones who are punished. MAC should set their own rates at the airport. I'm glad to stand the question.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Please state your name.
My name is Jerry Berquist. I live over in near Carlos Mariani's house over in District 3, Ward 2 in St. Paul. What I presented in front of you is a document provided to us by the Ramsey County Tax Assessor's Office that points out that the properties that are in question basically have tax benefits of over $630,000 every single year. And this was for fiscal year of 2007. The numbers are pretty consistent throughout that time. I bring it up mainly. And I need to correct something that Tom said. As Carlos did mention, there was a deal made with the property at Holman Fields when this came down in 1996. The payment in lieu of taxes that some of these properties are paying is a mere 10% of this this total number of $630,000. So they do pay something. But it's basically only 10% of what they could be paying. So we bring up to the issue about tax equity. As Tom mentioned, should these large corporations that are doing quite nicely, by the way, should they be relieved of their ability or their necessity to pay for the commons, for them to pay for whatever we need in the rest of the state, for what we need to have our workforce educated in the city of St. Paul, for us to pay for the items that are in the city of St. Paul? Why should they particularly get a break, especially now that the flood wall is going up and the flood and the properties at Holman Field will be worth a lot more? Why they should be getting a break and other companies, for instance, Captain Ken's Beans in St. Paul, you know, he doesn't get this sort of tax break, and we're wondering why the large corporations at Holman Field should. So it's basically a tax equity issue. Our district council organizer, Carlos Garcia Velasco, would be here to make mention of that, about some of the people that have a little trouble paying their property taxes in the west side of St. Paul. But he is ill today, is not able to do that. But thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mr. Berquist, thank you so much.
All three of the district councils, Westco, Dayton, Bluff, and District 1, all voted in support of this.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sorry. Representative Earhart, do you have a question for a testifier?
Mr. Chairman, I just wonder who owns the Holman Field. What's this relation to the Comac and so forth?
Question is, who owns Holman Field? Mr. Diamond, could you answer that?
Actually, most of the airport is owned by the city of St. Paul. Part of it is owned by MAC. They acquired some additional property. It's operated by the MAC. But the property we're talking about as far as the taxes is not the airport itself or any of the MAC property. It's the personal business, the privately operated personal or corporate businesses.
Well, Mr. Chairman, are they on the airport property or what?
Yeah. Mr. Diamond?
Yes, and it's just Representative, yes, they are on a leased property. It's a city-owned property that is operated by the MAC and is leased by the MAC. Some of the buildings, some of the structures are leased structures. Some of the structures are privately owned structures.
Thank you. Thank you. Hmm. Representative Earhart, are you a little confused too? I'm looking at, and maybe this is for Mr. Berquist or Ms. Diamond, I'm looking at this sheet here and I've got a list of all of these parcels of property. And if I understand Mr. Diamond correct, some of these are owned by the city and some are privately owned, some are leased. How does that work out off this list here that we've received? Mr. Diamond.
It's just a breakout of the buildings, but as far as the ownership, you have to go to the county and get the actual breakout.
But I just know from experience and working with the county and looking at these properties and some of the testimony that we've had in other hearings is that some of these properties, for example, some of the buildings were built actually by the federal government and then were turned over to the city after World War II. The two large wood hangars were built by the Department of Defense and then turned over to the city, and then those were operated now by MAC and leased to private entities. But there are other buildings that were actually built by private corporations on to the leased property. So there's a variety of different issues here at this site.
Okay. And Mr. Hines, you want to just explain what you told me to, if you would, please?
Mr. Chairman, I was just pointing out that companies that either own property at the airport or that lease from a public agency such as the airport, the Holman Field itself, are still liable to pay property taxes regardless of whether it's owned or leased land. If they're still liable for property taxes. They may now pay the county tax and would pay city and school district taxes under this proposal.
And in fact, all these properties did pay. It was only in 1996 that was removed.
96.
And other properties, for example, at the other airports, Anoka, Flying Cloud, etc., Air Lake, all do pay taxes. Similar situations.
Representative Earhart,
there was a representative from MAC. I see him up there. I think we'd like to hear. I would like to hear from him.
Sure, we will. But
okay,
Representative Earhart, why don't we hold on here? And because I think there's other testifiers. Representative, anything else, Representative Earhart? Hey, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Diamond, some of the property is leased by the city to these entities, and some by MAC, or is it all by MAC or all by the city? How is that?
Mr. Diamond.
The way it is the airport actually was a city airport, city-owned property. Since then, there has been some additional property that's acquired to expand it, which the MAC owns straight up. But the basic airport is owned by a bulk of the airport is owned by the city of St. Paul. In the 40s, after the war, World War II, the airports were consolidated under MAC and the legislation. And at that point, that airport was operated by MAC, but the city retains ownership of the land, underlying land. But MAC does the actual leases of it. They are the ones who have the authority to operate the facility.
Representative Anderson.
So does that lease money go to the city then?
No, it goes to the MAC.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Lanny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mariani, has the mayor and city council taken a position on this?
Representative?
Chair, members, I don't believe they have. They did prior when we did the change in 96. They actually supported the unattachment, both the school district and the city. I believe both through the mayors and the city council as well. But at this point, I don't believe that they've taken a stance on this issue.
Representative Land?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're on risky ground if we're doing something that the city of St. Paul hasn't even asked for. And I would expect the city of St. Paul is not going to want to run the risk of any of these companies pulling their operation out of Holman Field because of the economic impact that might bring.
Sure. Okay. Representative Marianne, do you have other testifiers?
I do not.
Okay. All right. Mr. Diamond?
Go ahead. Chairman Lanning, that issue was raised at the Senate hearing on this, and City Council President Kathy Lantry was in attendance and was asked, what is the city's position? And she says the city is not opposed to this change. They are not in opposition.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Diamond, I think for us to consider something like this, I think we need an indication, a formal indication from the city of St. Paul whether they're really requesting this. And I would seriously doubt that they're going to want to do that.
Representative Earhart.
I have to apologize, Mr. Chairman. What was your position, Mr. Diamond, with this whole world here? Who do you represent or what?
Mr. Diamond. Public citizen.
Excuse me?
Just a public citizen.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Diamond. Anyone that cares to testify for or against House File 3509? And please state your name and please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Quinn Coomer. I'm the general manager for Signature Flight Support at the St. Paul Downtown Airport. Our business coordinates and provides various ground support services for business and general aviation aircraft. And in addition, our company provides services for 24 hours a day for emergency services aircraft and medical response aircraft in addition to that. I'm speaking today on behalf of the tenants and employees at the St. Paul Downtown Airport, some of whom have taken time away from their job to join me. We're here to voice our concern over the potential legislation changing the tax status for businesses at our airport. As you know, Senator Pappas and Representative Mariani originally authored the bill that provided Holman Field a tax exemption back in 1996. At the time, St. Paul was underutilized and struggling. It was imperative to make the airport an economically viable enterprise that would create jobs, promote growth in the community, and relieve some of the congestion problems at the international airport. The intent of the tax relief was to level the playing field with the international airport. They were already detached, creating a competitive advantage on their behalf. In exchange for the exemption, the tenants at the St. Paul Airport agreed to make annual payments to the city for police and fire, increase the total market value of the airport property by at least 20% within the first 5 years, and work with local students to provide mentoring and promote careers in aviation. 12 years later, the 1996 legislation has been and continues to be a resounding success. There are currently over 300 people employed at the airport. The local area has enjoyed a substantial impact on business activities, including car rentals, local restaurants, hotels, and various other mom-and-pop businesses. People utilizing the airport provide a boost to the local economy, and it's estimated that the economic benefit of that to the surrounding community has grown to over $112 million annually. In regards to the total market value of the airport property, we experienced a 200% increase in value as of 2001 and a total increase of $21 million in value since 1996. The investment in Holman Field tenants have made has caused the market value to far exceed the objectives of the original agreement. The tenants at the St. Paul Airport have clearly met the commitment to promote education and mentoring, too. We have an employee at Signature that spends a significant amount of her time devoted to this mission. She's formed a partnership with Farnsworth Aerospace, which is an aviation-focused elementary school on St. Paul's east side. We provide tours, donate money, books, pilot supplies, and this school's been so successful that they're contemplating expansion. On a more personal level, I've been involved with an organization called ACE Camp for several years. This organization is a joint venture with the FAA and the Department of Transportation and several local aviation companies based at Holman Field. And it provides week-long summer camps for high school students to introduce them to various aviation-related careers. We've also worked with St. Paul Connections and the public schools to ensure economically disadvantaged students are allowed an opportunity to participate at a reduced rate, or in many cases, free of charge due to the donations from local businesses. Of course, we've also kept our commitment to paying annually for police and fire, too. And in addition, at one point, shared in the purchase of a fire truck for the city of St. Paul. So as you can see from these few examples, the relief provided in 1996 has truly been a win-win for the airport tenants and the community and various other mom-and-pop businesses around the area. The current bill that's introduced that would change the tax status is a great concern to us. With the recent economic downturn, it's really impacted our industry as a whole. The soaring fuel prices combined with the additional taxes and the competitive advantage Minneapolis would again enjoy would endanger the prosperity and future of our businesses at the airport and, quite frankly, force the tenants to make some difficult decisions. In recent years, our tenants have made considerable capital investments at Holman Field. We survived 176 days and millions in lost revenue due to floods. We struggled through the effects 9/11 had on our industry, and we now fight to achieve success in a very difficult economic climate. Now, some have characterized the current tax exemption as a loophole. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the businesses and employees at the St. Paul Downtown Airport strongly disagree. We feel the current tax policy is necessary for the survival of our airport, and it's clearly been a mutually beneficial arrangement for the city, airport, and surrounding community. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Coomer, do you know, you talked about payments for police and fire. Do you know what those payments are annually, and have they gone up over time since 96?
I know in 2007 we paid $63,279 as a group, as an airport.
To the city for police and fire?
Fire.
And then was there any dollars to the school district, did you say, or not?
63. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, dollars specifically to the school, we've made donations.
Okay.
As I stated before, we have an employee who spends a fair amount of her time on the payroll, setting up tours for schools, working with Boy Scouts, doing all sorts of things in the community.
Very good. Other questions for Mr. Coomer? If not, let's next gentleman here.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. My name is Al Rudd, and my company is Minnesota Jet. Minnesota Jet's been on Holman Field for 20 years, and I've been flying out of Holman Field personally for 30 years. Minnesota Jet manages and operates the flight departments for several major corporations, all of which call the Twin Cities home. One of those companies most of you would most likely recognize is Anderson Windows. With respect to the comments made regarding the tax proposal, there are 2 points I'd like to expand on and make clear. Number one is how much Minnesota Jet and the flight department we manage currently pay in fees and taxes per year to operate out of St. Paul. And number two is how increased taxes will directly affect the companies we work for. With respect to the fees, last year, 2007, now this is just my company and my affiliates, so I'm only speaking for myself. In 2007, last year, I paid in property taxes $14,116. This is what it is. The city services, my portion of the city services, was $3,800, for a total of $17,900 in taxes and services. In max fees, I paid, in the percentage of revenue fee, I paid $12,072. In landing fees, I paid $30,000. And in rent or lease payments, I paid $26,000, or a total of $68,218. Last year, for the state registration stickers on the airplanes, then they're the same thing as your license tabs would be on your cars. Collectively, we paid $274,000. I'm going to say it again. $274,000 we paid just to park the airplanes at Holman Field. If you go to New Richmond, you don't pay anything. For a total of $360,316. Now, granted, they go to different places and what have you, but I mean, those are what we paid, and I would have to believe that some of the other companies would be very similar. So, when we talk about the fair tax policy for the St. Paul community at large, you know, we think it's important to look at the larger picture, the extra taxes that we pay, and that we are, in fact, generating as a result of the successful partnership with the city and the activity at Holman Field. We're happy to produce those taxes for the city and the state, and we hope that you'll allow us to continue to do so. Now, number two, with respect to the proposed taxes and who they affect, let's use Anderson as an example. Over the year, Anderson has given millions to the city. Point is there good to the city? Let's fast forward. I don't think anybody here thinks that the current housing situation is no secret.
that business in general is off about 40%. 40%. Put that in perspective. Be like going home tonight and all of us get a letter in the mailbox and say they're going to take away 40% of our income for the next 3 to 4 years. That's a big number. That's a big number. Everyone in the industry, including Anderson, is doing everything possible to control or reduce these costs, including making adjustments to the flight department to be able to weather this economic downturn. We don't expect it to turn around until about 2010. Cardinal Glass, another one of the companies that we operate their flight department for, they make all the plate glass for the windows that go into Anderson windows, Tele windows, Marvin windows, what have you. They're in the same boat. They're off 40%. Bottom line, with the economy the way it is right now, it's not very business friendly. In closing, I just like to say two things. Please understand that most of us based at the St. Paul Airport are paying many, many, many thousands of dollars to operate there. We accept this, and I'm comfortable doing so. But like I've stated, the numbers are significant. And secondly, given the current state of the economy, especially aviation, I don't think right now, you know, for the foreseeable future would be the right time to increase those tax burdens. Thank you.
Mr. Rudd, thank you very much. Anyone else here to speak for or against? Okay, please come forward. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dietrich, your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask a few questions because I represent part of Anoka County,
sure.
And obviously Anoka County has an airport also. So can you tell me, when you talk about the different businesses and that type of stuff who utilize your airport, are they carrying merchandise? Do they get to be that large, or are they corporate jets? Give me an idea of what type of carriers go in and out of the airport.
You mean with respect to, like, passengers? Or you mean goods and services?
Yeah, so give me an idea of what type of...
I would say, 95% are all corporate airplanes?
Yeah, corporate general aviation.
Corporate general aviation.
So when you talk about...
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. So when you talk about Anderson windows and such, it's normally the it's corporate type.
Right, it's the port and their employees.
Mr. Rudd?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go through the chair, please.
Oh, okay.
So we can just go. We got it on tape. Who's speaking, okay. And so forth. So, Representative Dietrich.
Okay, thank you. So, make a case for me, would you please, that St. Paul Airport should be treated differently than Anoka County Airport. And then, secondly, the second part of that question is: there are many people in the area that I represent that. Talk about things like LGA that Representative Mariani just brought up, that we pay into the LGA of St. Paul to help subsidize some of those good things that they do, and possibly home and field might include that. Make a case for me why this airport should be treated differently than Anoka County Airport.
Mr. Rutt, I'm probably not the expert on how the fees were structured, but what I can say is that there's a different, number one, how the MAC charges back to the different airports are different. Anoka, I don't believe, pays the same fee structure that St. Paul pays the MAC to operate. Ours is being higher, much higher.
Is that right?
In what area?
Well, like all the fees, like to give you an example. I'm sorry, I'm not.
Sorry, no,
I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay. Just so we know who's speaking here.
That number that I gave you for the MAC fees of $12,000 for us, I would guess that I would say to come up with those numbers. Mr. Chairman, there is somebody here that can answer those questions, and that's Mr. Killian with MAC.
All right.
Specifically on those.
Okay.
All I would say in closing is that we pay a higher fee structure than Anoka does. From a MAC standpoint. So any savings we may have in a tax base is way offset by what we would pay in the fee structure.
Representative Dietrich?
I will wait for the representative from MAC to come up and tell me what that fee structure is based on.
Okay, very good. We're getting a little bit
I understand your question here. I guess, how many testifiers do we have left that want to speak to this bill? Because I want to, we've got others on the docket yet. So why don't we, do we have a representative from MAC here that could come up here quickly and answer this question on fee structure without getting too in-depth? You please state your name.
Chairman Marquardt, members of the committee, Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. If I can speak kind of broadly about fee structures around airports, first of all, each airport is very unique, even in the MAC system. But if you went outstate Minnesota and you looked at airports, you'll find where communities actually build buildings and give free buildings to FBOs to run their businesses. Each airport is quite a bit different. Faribault Airport at one time actually had an RFP out where they had an existing structure there, and they actually gave free rent to the companies that came in because they wanted to get people to come into their airport. Some airports give the full fuel flow fees to the businesses, and so it's fuel flow fees, it's taxes, it's ground.
How does it differ now between Anoka and Holman? What's the difference?
Yeah. Just basically speaking, Holman Field has a landing fee actually that Anoka doesn't. The ground rental rates are different in the MAC fees, but I can tell you that our relationship with the community at Anoka is completely different than our relationship with Ramsey County. Anoka County recently bonded $20 million for airport improvements at that airport. They went out and actually issued the bonds to help the improvements and move them along. So although they're getting school districts and city taxes, there's been quite a commitment from that community up there to help improve that airport. They have moved it along and actually made investments in the infrastructure and leased pieces of the land as the primary tenant and are subleasing it. So it's a completely different relationship up there. I can add a couple other things, I think, to the discussion. I can be very brief.
Okay.
At the end of the dual-track airport planning process in 1996, when the state legislature actually looked at whether or not to move MSP or not, part of that legislation required the Metropolitan Airports Commission to go out and maximize use of the reliever airports, develop a plan, and implement using those reliever airports so we didn't take up capacity at MSP. We actually did that plan. This small tax, people call it a loophole, others are calling it other things, this small piece of this tax structure is a piece of that plan. We think it's a good thing. Earlier testimony said that we can actually discriminate against people from coming into MSP Airport. We cannot do that. If you can only afford a small airplane, you can still come into MSP Airport. We can't discriminate against operators at the airport. The only way that we can get new people to use other airports is to entice them away with good facilities, good cost structures that actually entice them away. If you own a Cessna 172 and you meet the navigational requirements and communication requirements, you can come fly into MSP Airport. So we cannot block people from just coming in. So these are tools that we use to actually entice operators to use St. Paul downtown.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. I'm going to call down next testifier, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to speak to this issue. I'm Stan Ross. I'm an employee at Wings Aviation Services, one of the newest businesses at downtown St. Paul Airport. I serve on the board of directors for the Aviation Hall of Fame. For the last 8 years, I've served on the State Aviation Advisory Committee. I also serve on the board of the Air National Guard Historical Foundation. In addition, I serve on the board of the Red Tail Project, America's Flying Tribute to the Tuskegee Airmen. I would respectfully ask all the committee's members to consider a question that was posed earlier with regard to taxpayers and equity. My question is, do all taxpayers create jobs? Our business has created 12 full-time jobs already. We anticipate creating an additional number, an equal number of part-time jobs in the coming years. We support other Minnesota businesses by our efforts. In addition to training career pilots, which are desperately needed in the aviation industry now, we support other businesses like Cirrus Aircraft, a Minnesota-manufactured airplane company. We have 3 new Cirrus aircraft in our facilities right now. That represents an investment of $1.5 million. That's substantial. That supports the jobs in Duluth, over 800 of them, in fact. We support the schools. At our inaugural open house on March 12th, We hosted 100 school kids touring our facilities, learning about state-of-the-art aircraft, aviation careers, and the opportunities that this industry presents. We support the Youth Initiative Aviation Academy, which helps at-risk youth consider careers in the aviation industry. I have personally toured over 5,000 school kids in the last decade through the World War II Museum, six base operators, manufacturers, and other airport businesses in the Twin Cities area. In addition to those efforts, we at Wings Aviation support public activities. We will be hosting an open house on Memorial Day to invite the people to pay tribute to the veterans of D-Day, the veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom. This is a free event open to the public, and in that way, we do help a share to support the schools, the community, the parks, and the industry. All of the employees at our company pay property taxes. We know the pain, and we know about the equity issues. That being said, I would urge you to support retention of this incentive because the incentive is working. Thank you.
Any other... Thank you very much, Mr. Ross. Any other testifiers for or against? If not, Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, I'll just conclude briefly. I don't use the word loophole. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. We have very intentional action on the part of this body a decade ago that created the current status in regards to the airport, and that was intentional. And so I don't think we're talking about good or bad guys here. And as I said earlier, it's been a while since I've talked to the tenants down there. I guess a decade ago I might have been the good guy, but maybe now I'm sort of the bad guy relative to them. But I think generally they're pretty good tenants. I think the real issue is that since we created the action, I think it is absolutely appropriate that we periodically go back and review those actions in light of changing times. And one of the changing times, quite frankly, is our collective failure to control property taxes from rising in this state at rates that I think are unacceptable to your average property taxpayer. So within that context, I think it's absolutely appropriate for us to revisit this and many other issues to make sure that the cost-benefit decisions that we made a decade ago in this instance still hold true today. So obviously it's something we're all going to have to struggle with as we consider this proposal and many other proposals and as you put together your bill. But I really want to appreciate the opportunity for you to take the amount of time you did today to review what is a very complex issue. And I suspect we could probably spend many long hearings looking at all the issues related to MSP and our reliever and intermediary airports around the state. And maybe it's time for us to modernize our approach in terms of tax treatment to those. Maybe it's not. But the issue is here before you, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have had this discussion with the committee.
Thank you very much, and I was not going to recognize Representative Lomchevsky because we're talking
I
about what I think, you know, somewhat, we're looking at a little bit of a, what looks to me like a TIF district and business subsidy, and so I suppose I have to call on the chair, but Representative Lomchevsky.
That's Senator Marquardt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wasn't going to say that.
Oh, okay.
The full tax committee has heard a bill that I have, and we have not yet taken public debate. So much of the folks who have testified in your bill will testify in mine because I'm taxing both MSP and Holman in my bill. And you probably were completely unaware of this, but I'm not linking it to school districts. I'm only having them pay the state general levy so that those folks who are getting an exemption from paying the state general levy, like all commercial industrial properties, would now begin paying it. So this discussion will continue. You've got a little different twist here with schools and your city stuff, but I do want to just throw in that I think Representative Dietrich has raised a really good issue, the competitive why are some paying and not others, and the greater Minnesota airports do not pay property taxes, and then those in the metro do, except for Holman and MSP. So I think it is time, as Representative Mariani has said, for us to take a look at that and try to restructure how fair it is and who's paying taxes and why not. And I just want to say, Representative Marquardt and Chair Marquardt and to the committee, you know, I think the testimony that because people pay fees and other things is really irrelevant. And I'll tell you why. It's they're getting things for those fees, which has nothing to do with their property tax burdens. And I don't think committee members should confuse them. We certainly don't do that for other folks in their property taxes. That's because they pay other kind of taxes and fees and fines and all kinds of things that somehow they get an exemption from property taxes. So I think it's something we are going to have to think about. I also think the idea of because jobs are created, people should pay taxes is one that does not compel me at all. So I think there's something in our psychology that's happened in Minnesota over the last, I don't know, 10 years, that if you create a job, you don't pay taxes. I just don't understand that. You are a beneficiary of creating that job as well, or you wouldn't be doing it. So I think the testimony on your bill, like many bills we hear in the tax committee, is sort of, you know, because I pay other stuff, I shouldn't pay this, or because I created a job, I shouldn't pay this. I mean, we in the full tax committee are dealing with job fees and all kinds of corporate subsidies, and a lot of these arguments are recurring. And I think your bill is one piece of many that the whole Minnesota legislature has to get its head around. And why should someone get a property tax exemption and why not? And so I look forward to the debate continuing.
With that, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm going to Representative Dietrich renews the motion to lay over House File 3509. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members.
Members, here's what I'm going to do. Because we actually do have a legislator that needs to leave for a very, very good reason. So I'm going to go to Representative Rukavina, then I'm going to come back to Representative Lumpkowski's bill, and then we will proceed. Now, as far as I know, there isn't anyone who has to absolutely leave as far as testifiers, but if there is, I want to know, but we're getting to the Fergus Falls situation here soon, too. So, Representative Rukavina, do I hear a motion? Do I hear someone that would like to lay over 2753? Representative Loeffler moves to lay over House File 2753. And we do have an amendment on this bill.
Yes,
Representative Rukavina. Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment. Do I hear any discussion on this? Just to put it in the form we want, I'm going to call for a vote. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Rukavina, please proceed.
And the amendment members just added that open meeting law would apply to the hospital board. So that's all that did. Members, this bill establishes a hospital district for the White Community Hospital, which is on the eastern end of the range, and like a lot of rural hospitals, it's not doing that well because a lot of their patients are Medicare, Medicaid, and the reimbursements have been slashed. So the city of Aurora came to me and asked if I could introduce legislation for a hospital district, which I did. I talked to Mr. Hines, and I think asked him that I'd like to raise about $200,000. So he came up with the 0.066088 figure, which I think the fiscal note says raises about $220,000.
Yeah.
It may be a little more because I've added a couple more small townships in that area and the ability of them to join in also. Members, I have a resolution so far been passed by the city of Aurora and the township of White, and in a nutshell, the legislation allows any community joining to first through a reverse referendum is in the bill as it came out of local government to form these districts or this district, and that's about it. I'd appreciate your support. There is a small fiscal note that there may, I think, could cost about $9,000 in 10 and 11.
Representative Rukavina, was it in testimony or somewhere that this could average between, if all the cities got in, $25 a household versus if a minimum number would be up to about $75 a household?
Right, Mr. Chair, I have some runs from Mr. Hines that if all the districts joined, or all the cities and towns that are in the bill, it would be about $38 on a $100,000 home. If just Aurora, Hoyt Lakes, and Town of White, it'd be about $70. by, and, you know, in some of the towns, the average home is like 60,000, so proportionately it'd be about half of that, so that's what we're talking about. I'm hoping the city of White Lakes set it aside and didn't vote on, act on it, and the city of Bowabic, which has annexed part of the town of White up by Giants Ridge, where there's a lot of extensive cabin seasonal rec property going in, would reduce it, but they haven't indicated whether or not they would join, which would reduce it considerably from that. So,
you know, one thank you. Representative Rukavina and maybe somebody else, in an unorganized township, I presume there's no government there. Right. And it looks like there'd be it would require a certain number of petition of citizens. Is that set up? How would that, I'm kind of somewhat unfamiliar how unorganized townships kind of work.
St. Louis County, we have, because of the size of it, there's some, quite a few unorganized townships, so that the county becomes their governing body. So it would take, I believe the bill says that after a petition of 51% of the members in the unorganized township, then the county would become the governing body and appoint those members for that unorganized township. There's, I think, one unorganized township that could possibly join us.
Any questions from members? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, is this a non-profit hospital? Or?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
Members, it was owned by the communities of the town of White, Aurora, and Hoyt Lakes, and then got spun off as a non-profit. They turned it over to the board. So right now it's a non-profit hospital. And the problem is, members, it's got an attached nursing home. And for some reason, when the nursing home is attached to a hospital, some federal laws kick in that lower reimbursement rates for Medicare and Medicaid. And so they're working through that. They've got a management company that came in now, which I'm not particularly pleased with. I think they're from Texas or somewhere, but you know, my aversion to having outside companies come in, but supposedly that's going to help the cash flow there.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps staff could help me on the next question that I have. Have we ever done this before at all? Or?
Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not real familiar with this situation, but there is a general law allowing creation of hospital districts, and in the second paragraph of the overview of the bill summary gives a little contrast of how this situation differs from the normal situation, but there certainly are other hospital districts in the state. Do you have anything?
One of the biggest differences, usually the cities and towns must be contiguous. In this situation, they are not, I think, is one of the big differences. But is there anyone here wishing to speak for or against this House file? If not, any closing statements there, Representative?
It's very interesting, Mr. Support, and I thank you for allowing me to get home and go to the doctor and try to get rid of this blood that I've had three times this year. So. I think you're all wearing me down. I think it's Representative Lincescu.
Well, even sometimes a healthy Representative Rukavina is tough to handle, much less not healthy, a sick one. So that's why I'm going to send you on your way if you can. So Representative Loeffler, reduce her motion way over House File 2753. Representative Rukavina, get better.
Thank you, member.
All right.
Have a nice weekend.
Thank you. Representative Lincescu.
What did I do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3382.
The Chair moves House File 3382. Very good. Representative Lincescu, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill basically changes the way we do a little change to our current abatement law. And currently, we have a 10% limit on our abatement law based on levy, and I'm changing it to tax capacity or tax base. So that's pretty much it. I mean, I folks who have followed the abatement issue know that when it was brought into being, before I was a legislator, the real intent of those who brought it was to get folks to stop using so much TIF. It made it more transparent and clear. It put more accountability on locally elected officials to make these decisions as to whether or not they were going to have people not pay taxes. And at the time it started, in fact, House Research tells me that when Representative Abrams introduced it, he had no limit on it at all. After committee discussion, there was concern that, you know, people might just go crazy with abatement and create this monster of abatement, so it was reined in. What's actually happened is cities have almost not used it, and counties have almost not used it, and it's a much better, from my perspective, tax policy than taxing from financing. And so this would, I guess, give a little nudge to have cities and counties look at TIF a little bit, or abatement a little bit more. We currently have $300 million in TIF and $2 million in abatement. So we're not using this tool very much for the locally elected officials. So this change hopefully would spur them to use it a little bit more. I'm delinking it from local spending decisions by putting it on tax capacity as opposed to levy. This is how we do local unit governmental debt in our public finance bill. When we allow local units of government to have a debt limit, it's not based on spending and levy, it's based on tax capacity. So that's pretty much it. I'm trying to help folks use this a little more freely than they have been, and hopefully discourage the use of tax increment a little bit.
Thank you very much. And I kind of put my calculator to this, and just as an example, let's say you had a $1 million tax base, tax capacity, and let's say an average city levy of, let's say, 40%. Under current law, that 40% would bring in $400,000, and you could do currently 10% of levy. You'd be able to do $40,000. Under this, 10% of tax capacity, you'd be able to do $100,000. So there is a little more of a benefit there. So just
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. I think one thing to think about is why the current system says if you're a high-spending city or not, you're not equal. A high-spending city can actually do more than a low-spending city, which is not really something we would want to build in either. So that's exactly right.
Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lancheski. I'm just thinking about, I'm sort of absorbing how we're dealing with declining tax bases now, and since I agree that putting it on the tax capacity makes some sense, but if we actually had a tax capacity that was declining, because it's a community that's primarily residential and what's going on in the housing market right now, how would we, do we need some accommodation for that at some point? How would you deal with that?
Representative Lancheski.
Mr. Chair, you know, that's a good point. I mean, I guess 10% is what makes that a problem, and I'm not changing 10. Mm-hmm. I'm changing, is it spending or is it capacity? 10 is really the problem, I think, in your issue, because if you had no percentage, it wouldn't matter really what the value of, as value has declined. But I don't know. I guess I'd ask Mr. Michael if it's all right, Mr. Chair, to take a shot at that. I hadn't thought that through.
Mr. Michael, care to venture in on that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wofford, I guess if the concern is declining tax base, we could actually write into the law that their limit is, you know, the greater of their current tax base or the tax base from the highest of the previous two or three years or something like that. So that would give them a little more stability. I guess probably most places it wouldn't affect because homes are going down, CI has been going up, but in some cases that could make a difference. And so you could have some kind of an averaging effect so that it wouldn't drop.
Yeah.
Representative Lancheski.
Just a comment. Thank you to Representative Wofford. I think that's a good idea. I hadn't thought about that. I guess maybe hearing Mr. Michael, I was thinking 5 years as he started speaking, you could kind of say what's the last 5 year history. So if your economy is dipping, you would allow the locally elected officials to take the high water mark. All of these things are property taxes, so that's the part we all don't like, but this one is a better solution, I think. As folks keep coming to the legislature, it'd be great if people would start looking at this Representative Abrams' intent with abatement as opposed to keep going to the well for tax increment financing districts. So I'm completely open to clear. I think that's a good addition.
Any other questions or comments? If not, Representative Loeffler renews her motion layover, House File 3382. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lincheski, you have moved that, so we'll renew that motion, 3382. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Hackbar, Representative Lee, have you seen him around? Representative Atkins, we're going to go to you. Do I hear a motion to lay over House File 4022? Representative Dietrich does that. We have a motion to lay over House File 4022 for possible inclusion. Representative Atkins, welcome, and hopefully you're bringing this bill to us today in good faith.
Indeed I am, Mr. Chair. And better yet, I'm bringing it with peace in the valley. We started working on this about a year ago. It started off a little bit contentious, but we think we've addressed all of the concerns that people have raised over the course of the last year. It deals with aggregate, literally the ingredients for the building blocks for our bridges and our buildings. And what's happening, particularly in the metro area, but also statewide, is that the areas where aggregate is still located, there are development pressures. Those ingredients that we use to build our buildings and our bridges is getting built on top of because in many places the areas that the aggregate is located, the taxes are such that the owner of the property is feeling tremendous pressure to build. So before the aggregate is even mined out, a project goes on top of it. And then obviously you can't ever get at the aggregate again. And not only does that impact the ability to get that aggregate, it impacts the state of Minnesota, it impacts the economy, because this aggregate will no longer be available for use. And with transportation costs and the increasing costs of the material, we lose an opportunity when we have that aggregate remain in the ground. All this does is it says that the property that has aggregate under it, able to be mined, will remain at the 1% Class 8 A grade, so that they won't feel quite as much pressure to develop until and unless the aggregate is mined, and at that point it goes to a commercial rate. If they try to use it for anything other than mining that aggregate, if they go to develop it, then it'll go back to that higher rate. And so it's not like we're going to be missing out on anything we would have gotten. With that, I have Mr. Corrigan here, who can provide a little bit of additional testimony and is also here to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Mr. Corrigan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association. And I'll just add a couple of comments to Representative Atkins in saying this is focused on reserve properties, as Representative Atkins mentioned. That's the challenge that we have today is holding this property perhaps for 10 or 20 years in the face of development and in the face of rising property taxes. So this offers an organized approach for the appraisers to work with us through the reserve, the operation, and the reclamation of these properties. And that was the problem that really started this process for our members was we learned fairly quickly that assessors are black and white folks and not necessarily gray is an area that was causing them some problems. So we were seeing a lot of inconsistencies in how these properties were being treated across the state. And we think this solves it. As Representative Atkins mentioned, we've been at this for 3 or 4 years. We've been working with the counties and especially Dakota County, and we appreciate their help in making this language work properly for all of the counties. Dakota County is in the room and I believe supports this bill. The assessors support it, the Association of Counties support it, townships support the property tax portion and are neutral on the aggregate tax increase because they are both users and regulators. And the industry supports all parts of this bill.
We have worked with Dakota County to work on some of the termination language since last year, and we think we've fixed those issues. So that's the property tax portion of the bill. The new part of this bill is an increase in the aggregate tax from 7 to 15 cents. This was recommended by a legislative task force in 2000. It is their recommendation, and the basic, and Representative Rukavina co-chaired that committee, and I believe is the only House member left in office at this point, but worked hard on that for 2 years with the industry, with local government. The basic change in that is it changes the distribution. It allows it moves the counties from 60%, townships from 30% or host communities 30% to 42.5% and 42.5%. That gives the host communities more revenues to deal with the impacts of the industry in their host community, while also allowing, because of the increase in the tax, the counties to hold the amount of revenues that they're currently receiving. It also includes a prohibition on host community fees in those communities that are also charging the aggregate tax. Mr. Chair, that's a brief summary. As I say, we've been working on it for 4 years. We think everyone's had a chance to make the corrections that are appropriate.
Very good. Thank you. Is there someone from Dakota County here? Because, I mean, what were some of the specific changes that, I know there was concerns in the past. What are the changes from last year's bill that garnered some
that care there in the room? The termination issues, allowing the county to opt out, and
out.
How that we had that phrased was an issue that we needed to correct last year, and just how the assessors and the counties would work their way through this process was mostly language changes that we've worked with Dakota County and the AMC to make sure that everybody understands how this would be done.
I had a question, and maybe this is for the author, on if you place this into the agricultural or this aggregate resource preservation program, how long, is there a time limit on how long, let's say I'm an owner and I decide to do this and I never ever have any aggregate removed or anything. I mean, is there a time limit on this, or I just want to get a better break for all these years, knowing that there is some aggregate under me, but I may never have any intention to do anything. Is there a time limit on this at all?
You know what, Mr. Chair, I would defer to Mr. Corrigan. I think I have the answer to the question, but it'd take me longer to give you than Mr. Corrigan. So I think you might be better off hearing it from him.
Mr. Corrigan?
Mr. Chair, first of all, you do need to show that there is aggregate on the property, and that's with a professional assessment of the property. There are just actually kind of super penalties in this bill if the property is used for anything other than aggregate. So if you come in and never mine the property, you owe all the taxes back to the time you started this process. So yeah, that's really how
Mr. Kurgan, at what point would you do that? At what point would you all go back?
There's no time limit, but again, you have aggregate producers who today, as opposed to in the past, I think the major change, Mr. Chair, in the industry has been in the past, these were kind of ma-and-pa operations who were trying to keep this going into the next generation.
Okay.
Today, most of these operations are owned by larger corporations, and in fact, a lot of international corporations who don't necessarily want to hold this land for very long. They'd like to get in, they'd like to get it mined, they'd like to get it reclaimed, and they'd like to move on to the next piece of property. So we're seeing turnover much more quickly in these properties than maybe we've seen traditionally. But in the true sense, there is no limit to this. But again, I would tell you that these are corporations that don't hold land any longer than they want to hold them or need to hold them.
Very good. One other question I had is on the Subdivision 8. Once it becomes commercial, once they start taking out the aggregate, is it the entire tract that was under this preservation, or is it just the part that's actively being mined? And does that include where the trucks are coming in out, or the crushing? I mean, what's actively being mined? Because I can see where that could be a little narrow if it doesn't. What's that area considered?
Mr. Chair, it is only the part that is being mined. I think the easiest way to describe this is that, first of all, this land is going into a covenant, so we're working with the county on what is being mined and what is in reserve and what is being reclaimed. The easiest way for me to explain it is you take a piece of property, say 160 acres, that is maybe currently today under ag and is being, continues to be farmed. As the operation moves into that property, it goes immediately, all those acres that are being used for operation go immediately and without argument from the operator to commercial rate. And as you move across that property, that you see less reserve and more operation. And frankly, behind it, you see the ultimate use. If it goes back to agricultural, it becomes agricultural properties. It stays in commercial and becomes a retail center or residential area. That property behind the operation also changes. So it offers the assessor kind of a roadmap for how the property should be taxed as you move across the property.
And Mr. Corrigan, any big debate on the opt-in versus opt-out with counties? I mean, was that...
Mr. Chair, I think there certainly was some discussion about whether it should be opt-in or opt-out, and I think to make it effective and to make the commitment to enter into a covenant, the industry really felt this needed to be an opt-out provision, and ultimately the counties agreed with that.
Now, is the Association of Minnesota Counties, are they on board with this? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
They are in the room.
Very good. So. There's another point on the opt-out. They have 2 points or 2 years to do that, and then that's it? Or is that they have 2 years, and then after that, what are their options as far as the county? That was the clarification, too.
Mr. Chair, in the language and in the summary on page 3, subdivision 6 talks about there is 2 years to opt-out. And it also provides for when applications start to come into the county to be designated under this tax classification. So we think that we've covered the concerns that the county's brought up by extending, frankly, the 2 years effective date and putting that in place, and also how we treat applications as they come in. So it is a process, again, that we worked out with the counties to make this a process that the county understands they have some deadlines that they need to meet and clearly defines when they need to respond to these applications.
Very good. Anyone else Representative Earhart?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted you've got kind of a cliff going in. As soon as you start 160 acre mining on the edge of it, the whole thing becomes commercial. But I understand coming out of it, you're going to phase in the return to agriculture, which seems like a strange way to do things. Why wouldn't you declare the whole thing? Why wouldn't you take a section at a time or whatever into the commercial taxation if you're not going to mine the whole aggregate thing in over 30 years and you're going to be paying, even though you're going to be filing part of it, you're going to take it into commercial immediately upon starting. And you're going to do the reverse. In a phase in, you return to ag or whatever happens after reclamation and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, one of the big changes in the last decade has been how quickly these properties are mined out just because of the demand of it, but also the value of these properties once they're reclaimed we found to be quite great. And so we're finding that developers are coming in very quickly behind us, and where we might have not done anything with that 160 acres until we were finished the mining process, we're finding in properties in Apple Valley and Maple Grove and others that there's townhouses right next to the aggregate crusher. There's that kind of pressure in parts of the state, not just in the metro, and in parts of greater Minnesota as well, to get to that reclamation, whatever that might be. In most cases, it's residential or commercial, but in some cases, it's still agricultural. And again, this offers a process whereby the assessor, the county, and the operator can bring this property back to best use as quickly as possible. But at the same time, without argument, pay industrial commercial rates for whatever portion of this property is being used for operation or trucking or any of the parts of the operation that are associated with the mining itself.
Thank you. Anyone else here for or against this bill? Yes, sir, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley. I'm here representing the Dakota County Board of Commissioners. Dakota County has had extensive conversations with the industry about this bill, and they have addressed all of the concerns we've raised in the past. We are very comfortable with the opt-out, the language, and the period it worked. We are especially pleased with the restructuring of the aggregate tax structure that directs more tax to the cities or townships that actually host the mining operation. We think this is very important to increase the incentive for cities and counties to actually preserve some of the land within their boundaries for aggregate production. These host cities and their residents put up with all the adverse parts of aggregate mining, and we are very supportive of increasing the incentive for cities to and townships to host that. Aggregate, most of the mineable aggregate in the metropolitan area is in Dakota County, and plays a major role in all the building that goes on in the area, and the transportation of aggregate dramatically increases the price, so we're working to try to preserve close-in aggregate deposits for mining. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Atkins, any closing? Sounds like got everyone on board here this morning.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It was not an easy thing to come by, but I credit the parties for working very hard at finding something that works for everybody. And don't lose sight, this isn't just about the cities and the counties and the aggregate industry. The most important thing probably for legislators is that this is the building blocks for our bridges and our construction, and this will hopefully keep that price as reasonable and have the aggregate mine in the most efficient and economical and environmentally sound way that we possibly can. So that's the chief reason why I wanted to carry the bill, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you very much. And Representative Anderson. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I can definitely see this being an issue in the metropolitan area, having access to aggregate, and perhaps even in the regional centers throughout Minnesota. So we thought about just tailoring it just for those areas rather than having it broad statewide like this.
Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the benefits I think are most acute in the metro area, but they do apply statewide, and that's why we try to invite everybody across the state that wanted to be part of this to participate, and they've all bought into it, all across the Association of Minnesota Cities, obviously my own county, but the townships have been involved. Literally everybody's been involved and has endorsed it at this point. With the exception, I think the townships, because they both use it and they are collect from it, they took a neutral position with respect to that part of the bill. But we don't have any opposition to it from anybody across the state.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I guess I just think about my hometown area, and there's a lot of aggregate out in that area, a lot of different mines, and these, obviously where I grew up, there's not any pressure from development whatsoever, and I just see them paying a higher tax, and what will happen then is we'll wind up paying for more for our roads out in that area. And so I understand where you're coming from, but I think it might be helpful if we could limit it a little bit more so that we're not impacting having higher costs for our roads out in those areas due to the higher tax that those mines out in greater Minnesota would be paying.
Mr. Representative Anderson, I appreciate the concern. I think actually the opposite would be true, and I'd be happy. I'm going to stick Mr. Corrigan to talk about that very issue, because I think that the goal and the objective and the outcome across the state will actually be less costs to our cities and counties. But I'd invite you to visit with him further about that issue.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. So Representative Dietrich renews the motion to lay over House File 4022. Representative Atkins, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hackbart, we're going to go to your bill, and then we're going to go to Representative Norris's bill, and then Representative Taylor, and then Representative Dill. And I think that's the order we have. And we hear a motion for House File 3883. Representative Anderson, would you care to move to layover House File 3883, and Representative Hackbarth, this is a bill, I believe, that was in the tax bill last year.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate you hearing the bill again this year, Mr. Chairman. This was a bill that was included in the omnibus bill last year, and it's exactly the same except with a date change. What the bill is a property tax exemption for a electric generating, a peak generating plant that's going to be located in my district in the city of Elk River. And I believe that the, I know the city of Elk River and Sherburne County are both on board and in support of the bill. And Mr. Chairman, with me today, I do have Mr. Rick Lancaster with Great River Energy, and he can speak further to the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lancaster. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Lancaster. I'm Vice President of Generation at Great River Energy. We're an electric cooperative, a not-for-profit cooperative. We serve 28 distribution cooperatives that provide electricity at retail in Minnesota. Representative Hackbarth got it exactly right, this, and the chair did too. This was in last year's tax bill. It's for a 170-megawatt peaking plant, fueled primarily by natural gas. It's a $100 million project. The value of the personal property tax exemption is about $1 million a year. Projects like this are not economical in Minnesota without the personal property tax exemption because none of the surrounding states have a personal property tax on power plants like this. We use these plants for reliability. They run at times of peak demand on the electric system. They also run if there's a problem on the transmission system, they run about 5 to 10% of the time in capacity factor. We also use them to follow the ups and downs of wind power. We're adding a lot of wind power to our system as a result of the 25x25 renewable bill that was passed last year. And these plants will be available to run on days when the wind's not blowing, so they're good for that. We have lots of support for the project. As Representative Hackler said, the city, the county, also the construction trades, IBEW, are all supporting us on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Any from the audience for or against House File 3883? If not, Representative Hack. Oh, yes, we do have testimony.
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Anfang. I'm the president of Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here to ask you to support the exemption for Great River Energy on this project. This is the possibility of expediting this project a little bit, which we are very, very interested in. It's a jobs issue for us. We get along very, very well with Great River Energy. We respect them as an employer, and we believe they respect us as providers of quality workers. So the exemption we support, and we look forward to getting started on this project as soon as possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anyone else care to testify? Not Representative Hackbarth, any closing words?
That's it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for the hearing.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson, renews your motion to lay over House File 3883 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Representative.
Have a good weekend.
Yep, thank you. Representative Norness, I know the Fergus Falls group is here. And appreciate your patience. And do we hear a motion to move House File 3064? Representative Anderson moves House File 3064, and with that, Representative Norness, thank you so much, and
good morning.
You may begin.
And we appreciate the committee willing to spend as much time on a Friday morning. And I do have, Mr. Chair, a number of folks from Fergus Falls to help testify today on House File 3064. The Mayor, Russ Anderson, is with us today. A businessman, Rick Anderson, is going to testify today. And in the audience, we have a city councilman, Ben Shire, and Hale Stanislavski, who is in charge of economic development for the city of Fergus Falls. All available for questions if there's any at the end of our testimony. House File 3064 is a 15-year exemption on taxes that would apply to property formerly known as the Regional Treatment Center in Portage Falls. It applies to the main Kirkbride building, and I have a large photo of it here. It's a very large piece of property. The main Kirkbride building is that long white structure. There are some other buildings, about five of them, that you don't see very clearly on here, some you don't see at all, that would also be included in this redevelopment project. The request for the property tax exemption, the tax exemption, is one of the tools we need to redevelop this huge piece of property that formerly was state-owned. The key to this redevelopment, redevelopment is important when you have a piece of property that's vacant like this one, but the project that we have in mind, and we'll talk about here in a minute, will create a lot of jobs for that part of our region, and good quality jobs. And I think that's what all of us are looking for in the end. So not only reuse of the property, but a real good use, long-term use for that property. I think at this time I'd like to have Mayor Russ Anderson make a few comments.
Very good. Thank you much. And good to see you, Mayor, this morning.
Good to see you, and Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. You know, just a little history on this project. The Regional Treatment Center has been being phased out, and in the last several years, we have built a considerable unit for taking care of mental health issues for people. We are now in the process of putting together a 60-bed chemical dependency unit that's independent of this building, and when these two units are completely out of this building, it's going to be an empty building, but it's also going to present an excellent opportunity in our community. You know, this effort that Mr. Anderson will speak about here is going to create many, many jobs and have a huge economic impact on our community, and you will hear from him that this will be an asset for education and that will create opportunities for generations to come in our part of the area. I speak in support of this in behalf of our city and also from our various government jurisdictions, city, county, schools, and really when we think about this and the efforts that we are putting forth to get this to happen, we knew what will happen if this project that's presented will not come to fruition, and we're talking about some $7 million effort to demolish that very property. And I think when considering all that, I think we need your help to make this project work. We need your support, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and we certainly appreciate all the work that you do, and with that.
Thank you, Mayor Anderson. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Russ, or not Russ, this is Rick. Rick and Russ. Rick Anderson is a businessman in Fergus Falls, and he has worked tirelessly to put together what he's going to talk about now. He's very proud of where he's been and what he's been doing. So, Rick.
Very good. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Richard Anderson. I've been working on the redevelopment of the historic Kirkbride in Fergus Falls for approximately 18 months. We are in the process of developing a Minnesota Institute of Cross-Cultural Studies, which is a college in partnership with Hunan Province in China. I just returned from China yesterday afternoon. So after a 22-hour flight and 30 hours of traveling time, it is now quarter to 12 at night, so I'm a little... I'm not sure what time zone I'm in. So, but anyway, we have been working with a number of colleges in Minnesota. We've been working with a couple colleges in Moorhead, Minnesota, Concordia College and MSU. We've been working hand-in-hand with the Minnesota Community and Technical College in Fergus Falls in developing curriculum and partnerships between colleges in Hunan Province and colleges in Minnesota. My recent trip to China, we spent 16 days over there working with the Hunan provincial government,
And the first thing that we're working on right now is a nursing program in bringing up to 48 nurses over to the Minnesota Technical and Community College in Fergus Falls to get their registered nursing. We have the support of the Hunan Department of Health, and they are actually making this program part of their Hunan provincial government education system. If anybody's not familiar, Hunan is a province in China, and they have 70 million residents, and we have a delegation of 11 provincial government officials coming to Minnesota and Fergus Falls in June, and we have five university presidents that are coming along, both representing private and public universities in China. What we're developing is we're taking the Kirkbride complex, which is with all of the buildings, about 700,000 square feet of historical buildings, and converting them to dormitories, classrooms, dining hall, kitchen, and turning it into a campus. It's 118 acres. We have there will be investment both from China and from the United States on this project, and so we have broad support from both public and private colleges, not only in the United States but in China. So in the last 18 months, we've come a long ways. On May 22nd, I returned to China for a month. My wife's real pleased about that. But we'll be working with them and further developing the curriculum in partnership with our colleges here in Minnesota, and it should be a very successful project. As you can imagine, when you have 1,000 students coming to a community of 15,000, it provides a very, very positive economic impact. You not only have professors, but you have support staff, you have maintenance staff, kitchen staff. So it does create a lot of good jobs. There'll be permanent jobs. And then you have the additional impact from the 1,000 students. So it's a very positive thing for Fergus Falls. And the abatement of the real estate taxes is very beneficial in putting this project together, because having the taxes on the business does nothing but increase tuitions and increase the overall cost of operation. I will entertain any questions if you have any.
You have a representative in Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to tell you something and tell your author something. I went to the site this summer and walked all around it physically. And I have to tell you, I thought that whoever runs the... you know, I know nothing about mechanics, but the buildings in the back where they have the heating and everything, I think the guy wondered what I was doing out there because it was sort of this big deserted area in the back, and I'm roaming around the grounds. I think he was trying to figure out if he should alert the local police. But I had been you know, about an hour's drive from there, so I was so compelled by that picture we saw last year. We all passed it around, and I thought, I have to go look at that. So I walked all around. It was very interesting, and I noticed there's like an outpatient facility at one wing of it, or some sort of chemical dependent treatment going on.
Chemical dependency unit, which
okay.
is being rebuilt in Fergus Falls.
Okay, and then there were a number of newer buildings, though, like, you know, as you come into the gatehouse to the right over here that were, you know, I think there was a Catholic Charities housed in one of them. What were those? And I stood and looked in all the windows and tried to...
I wish you would have called and we would have given you a tour of those buildings. Those buildings, up until last year when we were here testifying, was used by the school district, and one of the buildings was the Minnesota Department of Health, and then you saw the one with the sign that was Catholic Charities. Yeah. Catholic Charities was asked to leave by the state also. November of last year, there was a drop-dead date to save those buildings. A couple gentlemen from Fargo, North Dakota, that I've been working with, we put in a letter of intent on those buildings, and that's when we really started in earnest to redevelop the entire campus. It's sad to say that that if we wouldn't have stepped forward and put in a letter of intent on those existing buildings, those newer buildings that were recently used in October of that year, they would be gone today. They would literally be gone. So the state just considered them excess buildings. They were going to spend literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of tearing down usable buildings. And right now, today, that if we are unsuccessful with the redevelopment of the campus into a college, which is the most logical use for this project, the state will spend in excess of $7 million tearing down the entire historical building. So it's a sad state that we would be faced with trying to save buildings, but we need to find a viable economic reason to use them. And we do have one. We have a project that is moving forward. It is viable, but we need help to be able to financially pull it off. The heating plant that you saw is they used to be a refuge burner back there, and that has been shut down, and they've been burning natural gas. So the utility bills up there are in excess of $1 million a year. We will be converting the heating and air conditioning plant to geothermal. So it's about 400% more efficient. It saves on our fixed expenses, and it's good to go green. So we're going to turn it into a positive also.
And that'll be removed eventually, is it? Right.
The burners and everything will be removed, I believe, in May or June of this year.
Yes, Representative. Well, Mr. Chair, and I just want to—I just wanted you to know I actually went there.
I'm very pleased.
Representative Nornes was very persuasive in trying to get our attention, but I do think that you should pass that picture around for members to look at, because I think that was what intrigued me to go look. So I think people who have not seen it should take a look at it. But thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Yes, I wanted to add one more thing, Nornes, since you had indicated you had visited. There's a couple in Fergus Falls that have been organizing tours of that facility every week for I don't know how long, and it's amazing. They have takers, people that live in the community that have never really looked at it, and this is an extensive tour. Next time, we'll put you on that bus, because it actually takes you inside, and that's the most interesting part.
I see the mayor has a comment, too.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanceski, when you spoke of Catholic Charities, we relocated them in the city and in a new area, and it's a considerably larger unit than what it was, and it's very, very successful. And
Representative Loeffler had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm always glad to see us reuse old buildings that are unique, and importing students is an interesting concept, but it's the first I've heard of a potential new major expansion of a college campus. And is this in the Minsky plan? Are they going to have financial obligations related to this, or is it primarily just private partners, or what's the business plan in it? I know you don't have to go into detail, but just the general concept.
Mr. Anderson.
It's going to be a private college with private funding. From the financial aspect, we're actually working with the Minsky School in Fergus Falls, the Minnesota Community and Technical College. And these nursing students that will be coming over will eventually be staying in our facility, but they'll be going to school at the Minnesota Technical College and paying full tuition when they go there. So we're actually enhancing the enrollment numbers at the Minsky School. There's a lot of interest in China looking at technical training. So we're looking at all of the programs that are being offered within the Minsky system and providing those opportunities to these Chinese students. So it's actually a benefit for the Minsky.
I think there was some misunderstanding by some legislators at the very beginning that this would be a full-fledged, another college, more expense, all of the rest of it. And we don't see that as part of it. It's a very unique project, and should benefit instead of hinder or harm, particularly the college in Fergus Falls. They're very supportive of this idea.
We're focusing on international business, which are classes that are not being currently offered in Fergus Falls. But Morehead State up in Morehead and Concordia College up in Morehead, they're looking at it, and other members of the Minnesota Private College Council and other colleges within the Minsky system look at this as a feeder system to the Minnesota college system, because they won't be completing their entire education in Fergus Falls, so they will continue on and attend our colleges here in Minnesota.
Very good. Well, this is a very intriguing project, and it's great to hear the update on what's happening there. And last year we had something in the tax bill, which is a little different, but I think this is very, very reasonable for the what we can get out of it, and just the statement that's made that if the state has to come in and tear this down,
right.
What, $7 million? And, you know, it's quite an expense there.
Mr. Chair, just going to add, Dan, you drive that interstate highway that almost passes by, you're welcome to stop in to it anytime.
Yeah. Thank you.
We'll give you a tour.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, just a suggestion, and you can take it or leave it as you move forward, but, you know, we have converted most of our regional treatment centers into correctional facilities, and they really do represent in many ways a dark part of our history as well as a place where success in turning around lives has happened. It's got both sides of the coin, and I'm hoping that you can put a place in that campus to share that history and to have the people who visit there to learn about how our treatment of people with disabilities and serious health issues has evolved over time.
Representative Norman. The state had one special day, I believe it was last year, where they kind of recognized the history of that facility as they officially closed it, I suppose you could say. And I was surprised that the artifacts and all of the things that they had saved that would make a real nice addition for a small, not necessarily a museum, but sort of one place where you could put pictures and things that really represent the history of that building. So we wouldn't want to lose that, and the size of the building I'm sure would allow for something like that to be included somewhere.
Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question. How close is the nearest high school?
Mr. Mayor? Or?
We have two high schools in Fergus Falls, yeah. A public school and a private school.
Yeah.
Yeah, and are you talking that mile-wise? Or?
Yeah.
Well, it's just on the other side of town.
Yeah, I suppose it's at a mile apart at the most.
Mayor Anderson, 1 mile.
Yeah. One of the public schools on the east side of town, the private schools on the west side of town, and this is on the north side of town. And it's not a very big town.
Fergus Falls population,
14,000.
Yeah. And if I may make an additional comment, Mr. Chair.
Mayor?
Again, I'd just like to recognize the support we have from the city, county, and the school district for this project.
Very good.
Yeah.
Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, one last comment, I guess. Chairing the committee on high school redesign, I hope that, you know, you've talked a lot about the partnership with higher education and, you know, giving the kids opportunities and pathways to go to higher education. I hope that you also take into consideration the high school kids and providing them a pathway to some of that technical education and international relations and all that type of stuff. And that's exactly where we need to be going with a lot of our high schools in the state.
Right. Mr. Chair, I'd want to point out one thing. I mentioned our private school, Hillcrest Academy. They have a number of students. How many would you say?
25 Norwegian.
25 that are Norwegian students, and a number that are also South Korean students.
25
of those. So we're also international at this point in the high school. And I think that all of those people can, I think the system can work very well as we move forward.
Good. Anyone else from the audience for or against House File 3064? If not, Representative Nornis, any last words on this?
I appreciate the time that you've given us this morning to describe what we have. We're pretty excited about it. A lot of people, I think, when this facility was scheduled to be vacated by the state, felt we had a huge problem on our hands. What do you do?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's suddenly we have something that really looks pretty positive. So.
Well, we wish you the very best, and hopefully we can help with all of this. So thanks for coming up in Fergus Falls this morning. So with that, renew the motion for Representative Anderson to lay over House File 3064. Thank you very much. We're going to go to Representative Gill, because I know he doesn't have a lot of... I think this is going to be kind of a quick one here. So we're going to go to that, and that's House File 3973. Representative Loeffler moves House File 3973 for possible inclusion. Representative Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill allows for a county, for the county of St. Louis, to levy for the first responders in the Morris Fall Lake Rural Fire Protection Association and First Responder Association. Here's the problem. Morris and Fall Lake are the two townships that have organized the first responders. They are organized, those two townships. Then they have all of the unorganized townships that are around the city of Ely, Morris, and Fall Lake Township. A tremendous amount of the property value lies in those unorganized townships. And they have been trying to cope and make ends meet with the expanding training requirements for first responders, the expanding equipment requirements, all of those things. And they can't make ends meet with donations. The people don't live up there that own many, many, many of those houses. They live in the Twin Cities. They live in other parts of the state, or for that matter, the country, in other states, as far east and west, north and south. So this would allow the county, this bill would allow the county to do a levy on the unorganized territories within this Fire Protection Association area. And then that would allow the levy to be paid and used for first responders in that area. Now, frankly, Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you that this problem is not unique. Especially, I don't know, maybe it's unique. Maybe it's unique to my district, but frankly, I really think that we're going to get more requests if this bill passes. We're going to get more requests for this all over the state because unorganized townships don't have an authority to levy. Only the county does, and they don't have authority to levy for first responders. They have the authority to levy for fire. And so this is something that is becoming an increase. Let me give you an example in my little community of Orr. Orr is 6 miles square, but the first responders cover about 1,500 square miles. And Orr is 36 square miles. So we don't have any way to get from all those unorganized townships any funds to help pay for the things that we need to have. And so it's a problem, and we're trying to come to a solution. Frankly, if I had my way, I would make this statewide. The fiscal impact of it in this bill is no fiscal impact, except for there might be a slight amount of homestead credit, state-paid home homeowner, isn't that homestead relief. Paid a very small amount. Of course, with the statewide, it probably would be more, but this is a real problem. Hope I explained it good enough for you to understand.
Well, in Representative Billy, you have, because as I looked at it, as I was reviewing this too, does someone have a question? Okay. Now, currently in St. Louis County, does the county levy for these first responders? Does each individual organized township do that? How does that work right now?
Mr. Chair, the organized township levies for that. The county has no authority to levy for first responders.
And right now, these first responders are out in these unorganized territories responding to, even though you said there's not a lot of residents there, there's ownership, of course, there, but not a lot of residents, but they are. Now, with this levy be based on the number of calls? I remember when I was the mayor in Dillis, our fire department volunteers, and we had various townships we serviced, and there was a kind of a combination that we went off of their tax base, but also the number of fire call hours that were spent, and we averaged over a three-year span. So, I mean, is it just a blanket, would it be just a blanket levy, or would it be based somewhat on the amount of time actually spent in those unorganized townships?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the bill reads that they will certify a levy by July 1st. The association will give the levy to the county. And I could tell you that these associations are pretty frugal in the way they operate. They have to be. They've been forced to be because they can't raise the money because the people don't live up there. They got million-dollar homes with no one living in them except for a few weeks of the year, and I'm certain that their fiscal responsibility will be, very well monitored and controlled. And it actually will probably amount to pennies on a property tax statement when they look at this. I know our first responder in our little community is about, I think it's around $5,000 that we have for our first responders, and just for the first responders, and that's just a 1,500 square mile area. Although this bill wouldn't be for that area. This is specifically for the Morris Fall Lake Township. But no, I don't have the answer to that, Mr. Chair, specifically.
Yeah, okay.
I'm imagining that they are going to come up with a number that they need to make ends meet, and they're going to certify it to the county. The county is then going to assess it on the unorganized township. They will have their total budget. They'll take out what they're getting from the organized townships. That will leave the unpaid balance, or the balance, and then that will be spread out on the unorganized.
Yeah, it's sounding like maybe the county board would have the ultimate discretion to help.
That is correct. The county board could say, this is too much, this is too little.
Okay.
Correct.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, that kind of led into where I was going, which is just, if this is the precedent for statewide policy, usually levy authority is from a publicly elected or accountable group, and this is sort of an association. And so I was kind of wondering whether we ought to have some guidelines or some public review, so it's not just a nonprofit association. I just don't want us, years down the road, I trust you, Representative Dill, that your people are pretty conservative, but in some other area, we don't want to all of a sudden have, you know, that they've gone to some exotic places around the world to take course in their training or whatever, even though I don't think that's the intent. And I just think if it's going to be the model, we might want to just have some kind of county board review or some other kind of public accountability stop along the way when it's dealing with the budget of a private association.
Well, I'm going to have Mr. Hines to that point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I was just pointing out to Representative Marquardt that the bill actually doesn't provide that the association is in any way spreading the levy. The association really just certifies to the board the area that they're serving. And so there isn't any words in the bill that imply that they're going to determine a levy. It really, you know, how it would really work with the county board isn't clear. But all the, because I had to read it a couple times myself, the only thing they're certifying is what areas of unorganized townships they're covering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're leaving it all to the county board to decide, you know, how much levy to spread in that area, et cetera. So.
Representative Dill.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that the county board is the elected body that will make the final decision. And, you know, the county board is so sensitive, particularly, and, well, I suppose every county board is, but St. Louis County is just like, I mean, property taxes there are so high already that they're not going to just fall out of bed to raise property taxes, you know, at a wholesale level. They're going to make sure that every dime is spent, you know, appropriately. The homes we're talking about that are out in this thing pay property taxes like some of the suburbs do, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 a house. And you know, mine is just I live in a shack and I pay $4,900 for taxes. And if I have water in front of the place, you know, that's gold, I guess.
Representative Dill, isn't St. Louis County the county where Representative Lucavina eliminated a position a few years ago on a House floor amendment? So we keep a close eye on St. Louis County.
Yes.
I remember
Representative
that.
Representative Lucavina loves to do things like that.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Representative Dill, you could speak to this, but I'm assuming it's basically northern Minnesota that has unorganized territories and not, I mean, because it's just sparsely populated up there. I mean, we don't really have a lot of unorganized territories south of there, do we? Does anybody?
I think it's mainly north.
It's
right.
Mainly.
Mr. Chair, let me give you an example. In Cook County, I don't believe there are any unorganized townships. That would be Grand Marais is the county seat there. Lake County, there may be four of the entire county, four unorganized townships, and that's where Two Harbors is the county seat. St. Louis County is phenomenally dominated by, in comparison, with unorganized townships, and Coochichan County, which is the next county over, I don't believe has any.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that we have them all by any stretch, but I think you characterized it correctly.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, then the other thing that I wanted to bring up is kind of on Representative Loeffler's point, because Representative Rukavina had a bill here that we heard today, and he was talking about, I think it was his bill, he was talking about unorganized territories and imposing a tax on those areas. And he had it in his bill that 51% of the people had to approve it. So it was a referendum of sorts. And, you know, even though you have probably a lot of folks that aren't Mulan residents in the up that area, I would think that they would want to make sure that their homes were protected against fire. So, I mean, have you thought about putting something like that in place to maybe address some of the concerns that Representative Lossler raised? Or
Representative Bill?
I think, I don't know, I think we're talking about Representative Gavina had
a white
hospital district, right? But that, I think that provision in his bill was an opt-in to, not decide on what the levy is going to be, but an opt-in to the district.
Yeah.
Because we have a similar situation up at the Cook Hospital District in Cook, and he modeled that after this. I can tell you that the ratio of residents versus, let's be frank, you got millions and millions and millions. I mean, we sound like Carl Sagan here. But, I mean, you got all this property that is, people don't live there. The locals will be glad to tax them so that they pay for the, pay their fair share. And so putting in a referendum, only the locals would vote on it. The locals are going to go in there and make a check mark and say, you know, we're going to tax the folks from your district. And, you know, they should be paying for part of this rather than the local people carrying all the load. So I don't see that would create, you know, really do much.
All right. Anyone here for or against this bill? If not, Representative Loeffler, I believe, initially will renew the motion to lay over House File 3973. Representative Bill, thank you very much.
You,
have a good weekend. And our last bill for the day, and let me get this, here we go, House File 3968, Representative Saylor and Representative Dietrich will move House File 3968 be laid over for possible inclusion. And we have Representative Saylor, we have an A1 amendment that looks like it's changing some things, 5% to 0.05 in percentage to its number, few technical things. So Representative Dietrich, will you move the A1 amendment? And any debate on that? This is kind of getting the bill into the form that the author would like. So I will call for a vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Saylor, welcome. And see, all your folks are here now and
yes,
ready to proceed. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, they had a nice long drive down this morning from the Midway. So they've been on the road for many hours. It was interesting to listen to some of the previous discussion. We're talking about unorganized townships. Beltrami County has a lot of that as well. And
Representative Saylor, when we were talking about this
yes,
bill the other day, you were showing me your map.
Yes.
And we saw a few of those.
Right. It was.
So forth, so.
I think my little favorite joke about my district is it's the third largest geographic district in the state, and we have a total of 5 stoplights. And the Chinese delegation found that very interesting last week when we shared that with them. However,
I would not want a county program aid formula based on number of stoplights per square mile. That would not be good for you, probably.
No.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. This bill is an attempt to address the chronic problem that we have in many of our northern counties, but in particular in Beltrami County, of some very high out-of-home placement costs and a low tax base. Again, some of those unorganized townships and a very large area to deal with and not a very high tax base. We've been having problems or just, you know, real challenges in Beltrami County with meeting the needs for out-of-home placement, paying for that, and then turning to the tax base, such as it is, to help meet some of these needs. And I will leave those details to the folks in Beltrami County that came down to testify. But now this bill will provide an extra $500,000 in county program aid to help this county address some of those needs. Because they've had to dip into their reserves this last year to meet some of those. So, without
Representative Saylor, this is a 1 year. Is that correct, or is this in future years?
Right.
I'm sorry.
Correct.
Okay, 2009 and future.
Correct.
Very good.
So, at any rate, first, I will turn it over at this point to Tony Murphy, who is the county administrator for Beltrami County, and I think he will explain a little bit about some of
you know, the history of what's been going on, and then we also have our assessor.
Very good. Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Maybe if I can give just a little bit of background about what has created this request. Historically, really over the last 50 years, the cost for out-of-home child placement, particularly for children located on the Red Lake Indian Reservation, were shared because basically all the lands on the Red Lake Indian Reservation are held in trust status. The costs for those out-of-home placements were shared by the Red Lake Nation, by Beltrami County, and through federal funds, through federal 4E reimbursement. And so it's kind of a three-way partnership that covered those costs. Approximately 18 months ago, the Red Lake Nation chose to cancel the 4E agreement that allowed Beltrami County to access the federal reimbursement dollars. And the Red Lake Nation at that point also, kind of on the heels of the tribal state human services agreement, chose not to contribute any longer to any out-of-home child placement costs. And so for an extended period of time, all of the costs related to out-of-home child placement for those placements ordered by the tribal court were being borne by Beltrami County. And of course it also happened at a time when we weren't in a budget cycle where we could address that through our normal budgeting process. And so we've been paying for those extra costs right out of our human services reserves. We're expecting at this point that that cost is right about $1 million. And so we have since been able to work with Red Lake in order to get them to re-enter a 4E agreement, this time directly with the state of Minnesota, which is now accessing some of those reimbursement dollars. But there's still a high number of placements that do not go through that federal process of qualification for reimbursement for 4E. And so those new costs are going to end up on our property tax levy. And so this is a huge hit for us. We are a property poor county. We'll allow Mr. Ebbinghausen to explain a little bit about that in the future. But we are not able to absorb large financial hits of those nature, and so it's really affected us. Now, for example, if we needed to increase our property tax levy through this upcoming cycle to cover this $1 million increase, well, that would be on its own just a 7% increase just by itself. And that doesn't factor in the other normal business service issues that we have to take care of as part of our normal county budgeting process. So it's a big issue for us. We're hopeful that this kind of funding may help us in the transition period while we're trying to hopefully the long-term solution we would hope is that Red Lake will ultimately be included in the Minnesota Indian Child Welfare Project, where they would have a direct government-to-government relationship with the state of Minnesota, where they would pay for all of those out-of-home child placements directly with state funds and federal funds rather than go through the county in that administrative process. Again, Beltrami County does not have any jurisdiction on the Red Lake Nation. The non-public law 280 reservation. And what's happening right now is basically we're just being sent the bills. And so we are paying. And we need some help to get out of that situation. And so, Mr. Chair, with that background, I'd be happy to respond to any questions as those come up.
I think we'll move to the other witnesses at this time. Thank you very much, Mr. Murphy. Who do we have? Assessor?
This is Mr. Dwayne Ebbinghausen, the assessor.
Okay, Mr. Ebbinghausen?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just give you some highlights of what our tax base is made out of. About 70% of our acreage is tax exempt, and that, of course, includes a lot of unorganized districts up there also. But we also have a lot of state land, the Chippewa National Forest, which is a federal U.S. forest, the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, or a portion of it, I should say, and also the Red Lake Indian Reservation, which is pretty much totally is within our county. I've been doing tax meetings up there for almost 34 years, and one of the complaints we always get is comparing our taxes against our two counties to the south, Cass, which Walker, of course, would be the county seat, and then Hubbard, which Park Rapids would be.
In both of those counties, roughly whatever our residents will pay for taxes on the county portion of the tax, those counties typically run about half of ours. And the reason is Cass County's tax base is about $7 billion. Hubbard is about $3 billion, and that's about where we're at, $3 billion. But the real problem is the relationship of the population to our tax base. That's what it really comes down to. Cass County has about 60% of Beltrami County's population, but it has over double of our tax base. And Hubbard County has about 40% of our population, and our tax base is, you know, about equal. And that's really what it comes down to, the relationship of your tax base to your population. And then also the wealthiness of your population. Cass County in particular is a great county to live in for property taxes. About 40%, over 40% of their tax base is owned by people that don't live there. They're seasonally owned properties. Seasonal owners typically live on higher value properties. They don't demand much for services. For example, they're not going to use the schools virtually at all. Most of them are wealthy enough, so they're not going over to the Human Services Department for aid. And Hubbard County also has a relatively, they have a lot of, the same amount of taxable parcels that we do, but their value is way more per parcel. Excuse me, they're a little bit less, but way more value. That's why their value is about equal to ours. And another thing is the new growth. You know, growth in tax base is measured more in the area of new construction, not inflationary growth. And Cass County last year had $165 million in new construction. Crow Wing had $215 million in new construction. I'm sorry, I don't have Hubbard's number, but ours is around $61 million. So when you add all these factors up, the tax-exempt acreage, the relationship of population to your tax base, and then the wealth of your population, has always been trouble for us ever since I've been there. I've been there since 1975. These are not new issues for us. It's always been that way. I was telling Tony before I came down here, I've done roughly 1,400 boards of reviews over the years. And the complaint from taxpayers, especially in our southern end, is the tax difference between our counties and our counties to the south. And keep in mind, Bemidji only lies about 3 miles from both of those county lines. So we have a lot of people that either have friends or relatives, or they themselves own properties in those three counties, and they notice the, you know, the big difference in what the tax base is and what the taxes actually are. So it's always been a problem. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Representative Taylor, do we have?
That is Mr. Jeff Lind, and he's with the, let's see. Anyway, he works with the out-of-home placement and child services. I don't know if there are any particular questions. He's basically here to answer any questions that somebody might have about that. And I don't know if he had anything in particular to add at this time other than to just be a resource on that. I would just like to add a little bit, you know, on the fact that Tony Murphy mentioned about the non-280 tribe. I think that's one thing that so many people don't understand. The Red Lake tribe is in a different status than any of the other tribes in Minnesota. In fact, there are only two tribes in the entire United States that fall into the category called the non-280 public law. And that puts them in a very different status. And when Beltrami County is the county that has almost all of that Red Lake Nation within that, it sets up some different situations tax-wise and also having to do with, you know, duties that the county and the state actually are constitutionally required to do. But I think the most important thing about that is to just let people know that there really truly is something very different in how the Red Lake Nation is set apart from the other tribes within Minnesota and almost everywhere in the U.S. In fact, we continually are
imploring our federal representatives and senators to take a bigger role in this, because we, you know, if there are only two tribes in the whole United States, we think that maybe they could help out with that a little bit more. But they have not done that, and so the burden of paying tax rights has really landed on Beltrami County. And you know, with some of the other situations going on unrelated to that that counties are dealing with, it really does become a big burden. And we hate to, you know, be pitting any of our citizens against each other. And some of that tends to happen. It kind of goes in that direction sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to do that. You know, we have one set of, you know, not particularly wealthy people and paying in. And it just, we'd like to avoid those situations. So I just wanted to mention that part because it is difficult and most people don't know about non-280. I certainly didn't earlier, but I have learned quite a bit. And I think that that's an important piece to look at. And also, as Tony Murphy had mentioned earlier, we have been trying for the last 3 years to, and probably longer than that, but 3 years that I know of, to have the Red Lake Tribe incorporated into that project. And we have tried every year and been unsuccessful at doing that, but we will continue that again next year in the budget session to try to get Red Lake into that project. They want to be there. Everybody wants that to happen, but there is a cost to the state, and so they have not done that. But at any rate, we will continue to pursue that because it will be in the best interest of the children, the tribe, the state, everybody. But I will turn it back over to them if there are any other questions.
Yeah. Well, in Representative Taylor, Mr. Murphy, you weren't able to enter a 4E agreement, it sounds like, which really increased some funding. But I see the funding here is permanent, or for future years, and certainly your loss would not be the same if you were now to enter into a 4E agreement, or if there were some other options that the federal or the state government came into. So, you know, your loss wouldn't be nearly as much as it was this year without the 4E. So I guess I'm wondering what the rationale is, because we've done this for, well, you know, a situation where they're losing tax base, Mahnomen County, for example, and we provided some extra dollars, but also in the hopes that they work some agreements out and so forth. But what would be the need for a permanent funding here, or not, or at least kind of waiting to see what happens and taking it more of a short term, and then we can come back and revisit and so forth?
Mr. Chair, I think that's an excellent question. We have been successful at really entering into a 4E relationship with the tribe through the state, and that's going to be very helpful. Where we will not receive the help is, historically, Red Lake has a number of children that do not qualify for 4E, and or they, as those children are being processed through Red Lake Social Services or through the Red Lake courts, they are not completing all of the necessary documentation or other kinds of supporting qualifications for their eligibility in for 4E reimbursement. And so the tribe was paying for those placements directly. They were paying for those placements directly. They won't pay for those any longer. And so what has happened now is the cost of those placements have been shifted from Red Lake to Beltrami County. There is no federal reimbursement. There is no state funding for it. And that's being shifted then from Red Lake sources. They were receiving some federal dollars for a while for those placements. And they haven't been able to tell us whether they're still receiving those federal dollars or not. But what's happening is there's a shift taking place for those non-eligible placements from Red Lake financial obligations to our property tax rolls.
And is it because of the lack of a 4E agreement, or for other things, for other reasons?
Just for other reasons. They're just not qualifying because they're a relative placement, or because of just a number of criteria that they may enter into in their unique situations up there that they don't qualify for federal reimbursement.
Is that because of law change or something else? I mean, is that because of law and criteria changes? I'm not quite understanding why now they're not qualifying, even without the 4E agreement. I'm not quite clear on that.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, for most of those placements, they never did qualify.
Oh.
And so, you know, again, it's a different governance structure up there in Red Lake where they may have situations where they just want to place children for a variety of purposes that were being paid for under tribal responsibility. And so they've been paying. Now those costs are being shifted to us. The challenge you run into, and this is the sensitivity that Representative Saylor, I think, was also explaining, it's very difficult to go through a public process as a county board and say we are increasing property taxes 7% so that we can pay for services that are being ordered by Red Lake Tribal Social Services and Red Lake Courts on the reservation, and the reservation does not generate property taxes. And so it becomes a situation that's full of conflict, and we really do not want to enter into that conflict. It doesn't benefit anybody. It doesn't benefit the children. That's the other reason why we've been pushing so hard to try to have Red Lake included in the Indian Child Welfare Project, because that way there is a process basically where some of those costs get more equalized over the state rather than just become the burden of one, a very property poor county.
Mr. Murphy, do you have any payment in lieu of taxes arrangements with the Red Lake Nation? I mean, is there any contracts you have or anything like that where they pay a certain amount for in lieu of other taxes or anything with the county?
Mr. Chairman, we do not receive any payment in lieu of taxes for any of the lands inside the sovereign limits of the Red Lake Nation, none whatsoever. We do on some of the lands that are around the reservation. There are some state forests and wildlife areas, and there's some state and federal lands. On those we do, and we are governed on how we distribute those proceeds around. We do receive approximately $400,000 a year out of the state budget for Red Lake aid. It is not designated for out-of-home child placement. It's just for a variety of services that we provide on the reservation that are not compensated for at this point. And I guess, for lack of a better way of looking at this, this request we have before is a little bit of an expansion of that aid so that we can meet those needs without having to put them on the property tax rolls.
And are you saying that the needs that you have are about $1 million, the actual cost? Is that just with the out-of-home placement situation, or is that more?
That's just Red Lake out-of-home child placement.
What do you suppose all of it would total? I mean, you're getting $400,000 in aid from the state. Is that covering your costs other than out-of-home placement?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't even come close to the services we provide up there with our income maintenance unit that we offer on the reservation, a variety of other services, human and social services we provide on the reservation. I do not have an exact number for you. I can provide that for you. But it really is, for lack of a better term, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. Really, those costs are being borne by the property tax levies off reservation. And it becomes a point of, again, considerable conflict over time with our residents.
And I know counties throughout the state, not just those with reservations, are also experiencing some huge shortfalls because of the out-of-home placements and what the federal government is doing. So I'm sure that's part of also your problem, even outside the reservation in Beltrami County, is you've also got those pressures. So it wouldn't just be the Red Lake Nation that would be causing a shortfall. It would also be the other areas of the county also would be adding to your shortfall?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We are a high poverty area. We have high unemployment. It's a difficult challenge for us in an economically depressed area. And certainly the placement increases at Red Lake are growing rapidly because we're seeing some migration of population back to the reservation. That's been going on for several years. But out-of-home child placement obligations are also a concern in other parts of the county, absolutely.
Any other questions? Representative Saylor, any closing comments? What's that? Oh, I'm sorry, audience. Anyone here who's left for or against House File 3968? If not, Representative Saylor, you would care to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in view of the fact that we are last, I will just say that I certainly hope that the committee will give this some careful consideration, because it is a very big need in Beltrami County for a number of reasons, you know, that we discussed today. So I thank you very much for your time and attention, and we would be certainly willing to answer any questions anyone might have at any time. Thank you.
You know, we've talked about this, and I appreciate very much you're pushing this forward, Representative Saylor. I know it's been a huge issue for you, so I appreciate you bringing it forward. And also appreciate the testifiers for traveling up this morning, and have a nice weekend and safe trip back. And I'll renew the motion but Representative Dietrich will renew that motion to lay over House File 3968 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank
you very much. Thank you so much for sitting through 3 hours and 20 minutes of property tax. Oh, I'm sorry. You certainly may. I'm sorry I missed you. You certainly may. Is this on this bill?
No. It's on the whole property tax relief idea.
Oh. Is there a specific bill? I'll tell you what, we're going to have the property tax. I was going to lay out the schedule. Next week will be the last week we're going to be hearing bills in public hearings. And then we're going to lay out the bill, property tax division report, on April 11th, which is a Friday. I'm going to leave it. How long? 5 minutes?
Probably 3 minutes.
Very good. So let's proceed before we adjourn. Please
thank you.
State your name.
My name is Mary O'Connor, and I'm from Brooklyn Center, and I'm a council member in Brooklyn Center. I have my property tax statement with me today for 2008. My property taxes should be $8,000, according to this statement, but they are under $3,000 because the state pays over $5,000 as aids and credits. Plus, I am eligible for two more refunds, including the circuit breaker. Also, my taxable market value is lower than my estimated market value, so I get a benefit there. The state gives my city over $1 million in local government aid in 2007 and again in 2008. That didn't stop my city council from raising property taxes both years. If the state didn't give so much aid to cities, counties, and individuals, you could greatly reduce the sales tax or the income tax. If citizens had to pay the real cost of their cities and counties, they would elect officials who would cut those costs. My city uses tax-exempt financing to purchase land and businesses. Then the buildings are demolished and the land is sold to another business for $1 or an abatement. This is unfair to our citizens and to other businesses. If you would eliminate tax increment financing, you would bring relief to taxpayers. My city has to write a comprehensive plan, which will cost $60,000. It is required by the Metro Council. Also, the Metro Council has the power to levy property taxes, which we all pay. If you eliminated the Metropolitan Council, you would bring relief to citizens and cities, and you would save about $1 billion each year, with which you could reduce sales or income taxes. The real problem is all levels of government have gotten too big and spend way too much. All we need from government are roads, bridges, utilities, parks, basic education, and public safety. The rest is best handled by citizens. Thank you.
Ms. O'Connor, thank you very much. Appreciate that. And thanks for waiting until the end. I didn't realize you were here. So thank you very much. We are adjourned. Have a great weekend.